This is okay. Hi. Ready, sir? Will everyone in the Missouri Senate please rise for the prayer by our chaplain, Pastor Gock, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance.
Johannes Tauler wrote, "If you keep watch over your heart and listen for the voice of God and learn of him, in one short hour you can learn more from him than you could learn from man in 1,000 years. Help us, O Lord, to set an hour in quiet with you and to learn of you and learn more about ourselves, for you have called us to be faithful servants. Bless our activities, for much is expected of us, and there is much to be done. Make us mindful that our work here is a collective effort, and we need to listen to one another and seek always to do what is best for all. In your holy name we pray. Amen."
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Brown, Callahan, Chappelle Nadal, Crowell, Cunningham, Curls, Dempsey, Dixon, Engler, Goodman, Green, Justice, Kevany, Kehoe, Kraus, Lager, Lamping, Lemke, Mayer, McKenna, Munslinger, Nieves, Parson, Pierce, Pergeson, Richard, Ridgway, Roop, Schaff, Schaefer, Schmidt, Stouffer, Wasson, Wright-Jones.
Senator from Green, Senator from the 7th, Senator from Lewis, Senator from Andrew, Senator from Jefferson. A quorum is now present. The Senate is in session. Secretary, read the journal.
Journal of the Senate, second regular session, 69th.
Senator,
President. Mr. President, I move further reading and the journal be dispensed with and the same be approved as though having been fully read.
You've heard the motion. As many as are of the opinion it shall prevail, say aye. Aye. Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Reading is dispensed with. Petitions, memorials, remonstrances, resolutions. Senator from Cole.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a resolution.
Send it forward, sir.
Mr. President, I request the reading of the resolution be waived, and I ask that it be printed in the journal.
Thank you, Senator. The reading will be waived. It will be printed in the journal.
Mr. President, this resolution is to grant the use of the Senate hearing rooms in the chambers to the YMCA Youth and Government meetings that will be held November 8th and 10th, and then again on November 29th through December 1st. I would request unanimous consent of the Senate that the rules be suspended for purpose of taking the resolution up for adoption.
You have heard the unanimous consent request. Does any senator object? Hearing none.
Mr. President,
we shall proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move the resolution be adopted.
Does any senator wish to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, the senator is recognized to close.
I close.
The senator renews his motion on adoption of the resolution. As many as are of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The resolution is adopted. And you have another one, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a resolution. I am sending it forward.
Send it forward.
Mr. President, I would request the reading for the resolution be waived and ask that it be printed in the journal.
Thank you, Senator. Reading will be waived. Print the resolution in the journal.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a resolution that would allow the Silver Hair Legislature, which we've allowed use of the chambers many, many times in the past, the use of the chambers on October 11th through the 12th of 2012. And I would request unanimous consent of the Senate that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking the resolution up for adoption.
You've heard the motion. Does any senator object to that motion? Hearing none, that is how we shall proceed.
Mr. President, I move the resolution be adopted.
Does any senator wish to be heard on that motion? Hearing none, the Senate is recognized to close.
I close.
The Senator renews his motion on adoption of the resolution. As many as are of the opinion that shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. That resolution is also adopted. On the order of business of resolutions, concurrent resolutions. Senator from 23rd, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of House bills on third reading, the formal calendar.
House bills on third reading, the formal calendar. House Bill 1051 with Senate Committee Substitute, Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. I ask that bill be put on the informal calendar.
Shall be so ordered. Thank you, Senator. House Bill 1403, Senator.
Mr. President, I would ask that House Bill 1403 be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion. As many as are of the opinion it shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is before the body.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move for the adoption of House Bill 1403. Mr. President, I have a Senate substitute.
Send your substitute forward, sir. Has it been distributed?
It has been distributed. I would request a waiver of the reading.
The reading will be waived. Senator, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for the adoption of the Senate substitute. Mr. President, we addressed the workers' compensation legislation earlier this year. We passed through both bodies and put on the governor's desk a bill that would have addressed co-employee liability and occupational disease and included the language that the senator from Cape had offered previously with the subrogation language. The substitute before us, obviously, upon gubernatorial veto, we need to go back and rework this. The governor did submit a letter asking that our solution incorporate a couple of ideas. First, we have the same co-employee liability language that has both passed this body this year and last year as well. And to my knowledge, there's no one in disagreement that this is the language to take care of the problem that was created under the Hooker case. And then under the, as it relates to putting occupational disease back under the workers' compensation system, the governor asked for a couple things. He had asked for an enhanced remedy where those occupational diseases are resulted in death, where they were terminal. We've added language incorporating that and providing an enhanced benefit in those cases. And then the governor also asked that, whereas under workers' compensation, there would be dependents and a spouse would receive lifetime benefits, the governor has asked that the benefits go to the estate in these cases, and we incorporated that language as well. And those are the substantive differences between the bill that passed this body and the Senate substitute before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Does any senator wish to be heard on the motion to adopt the substitute? Senator from Johnson? Oh, Senator from the 11th?
May I inquire, Senator from 23rd?
The Senator from 23rd yield?
Yes.
He yields, you may inquire.
Senator, a couple of things. We had previously had a draft of the substitute, and the only change that I think I see preliminarily from some of the other drafts is at the beginning, the word enhanced remedy, is that right? I mean, what's the difference between
right.
7 F and 6 F. Is there
that is one change from enhanced remedy, how we define that enhanced remedy for those toxic exposures. At the bottom of that section, I added a disease with enhanced remedy shall not be subject to attorney's fees otherwise provided for in this chapter. It's to make sure that as much of the judgment is going to the claimant as possible. That's the reason we're doing this. And I think if there was any other substantive change, we kept the payment structure the same. And those are the only changes that I have.
Okay. Do you have any kind of chart that defines what this definition of enhanced benefit is? I mean, what is this 133 1/3%?
It's 133%. Right now, you would have someone.
Do we have any kind of like chart or anything?
I don't have a chart. I can walk this. I can have somebody walk this over to you. But
okay.
Right now, someone, an individual would get in the instance where, let's say they died at work from a workplace injury, they'd get 66%, or their beneficiaries would get 66% of the average weekly wage. With the enhanced benefit, this substitutes 133% of the average weekly wage, and they would get that for a minimum of 200 weeks. So in the event that...
So roughly four years?
Yeah, just short of 4 years. There would be, in the instance where someone did not live for the, basically make it to 200 weeks, number one, they would get their permanent total disability payments, and then it's calculated by this section. It would amount 133% at 200 weeks would be $206,149.51.
Okay.
So the remainder would be given to the estate as a lump sum payment. And the permanent total disability amounts to the $28,140 per year.
Okay. Do you mind, Senator, if we just, I mean, you have been kind enough to share other drafts of this, but before we make this law, I mean, can we walk through?
There was, my chief of staff was supposed to talk to your office. There was one section that I believe he talked to one of your staffers that it's not in the substitute. And what I had asked is if you wanted to offer that by amendment, then I would live with how the body wanted to decide on that issue.
Okay. And what?
I don't have the previous sub, or I would cite the language.
Okay. I'm not privy to that issue, but I assume when they went through this bill. But can we?
Yeah, that's the one other difference.
Okay, and what was that related to? Was it related to occupational disease?
I guess there was some belief that your staff had some belief that someone would sign away some of their rights.
Okay.
And take a partial judgment.
Okay, what would that refer to? The totality of the disease? I mean, was that?
Yeah, I have to get.
I mean, mesothelioma was.
If I can get a copy of. I don't see.
Is that about how you can have. In 50% of your body, so the court only gives you 50% of the judgment? Is there an issue like that? Or?
Yeah, hopefully he's bringing the language to me.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I had asked to drop by the language to you.
Okay.
I ran into leadership, so I'm not certain whether that happened now or not.
Let's see. K, Can you just walk through, can we just walk through the bill, if you don't mind, Senator?
Sure.
Okay. On page one, the term enhanced remedy is hereby defined as a remedy for an occupational disease related to toxic exposure, and then we list mesothelioma, cancers.
They say toxic exposure.
Medical findings addressing cause, compensability, disability shall be
toxic stated. Exposure. We list toxic exposure diseases that result in death.
Okay, and
mesothelioma.
And medical science has a list of diseases that are considered fatal, right? So you state in the bill mesothelioma and certain cancers. Would someone who is inflicted with this merely have to show that they have one of these diseases by medical diagnosis?
Yeah, you can see where they are diagnosed by a board-certified physician who specializes in an area relevant to the diagnosis.
Okay. We list all that, and then we get to or death. Now, you talked a little bit about the average weekly wage, and I know it's in the bill, but what are we doing with the surviving families?
That's where
what kind of number are we going? I noticed the burial benefit went from
that's in all cases of death. That's just the death benefit going from $5,000 to $10,000. I look at that more of as a burial.
Okay, that's the burial issue.
Yeah.
But what about walk through with me, someone has a case, they're successful, they die during the course of the case, which is common. What happens to their families under your bill?
In one of these cases where they contract one of these diseases?
In a mesothelioma case, in a popcorn case.
No. In a mesothelioma case.
Senator, let's just walk through the basic thing.
Sure.
They're 65 years old. They find out they have mesothelioma. They, at some point, are successful in court. And either before judgment, during judgment, as they're about to get judgment, they die.
Mm-hmm.
They win in court. What happens to their family? How does this 133 and a third times the average weekly wage factor into?
Okay, that would be on page 14, is that calculation? Such compensation shall be payable for the life of the injured employee commencing as of the date of the total disability and shall end at the date of death. Should the employee fail to receive 200 weeks of compensation due to the death of the employee, the remainder of the 200 weeks of compensation shall be paid as a single payment to the estate of the employee.
Okay, so if
the provisions of this subdivision are not subject to suspension of benefits provided in subsection 3 of the section.
And do we know how much money is that?
That's what that was that 206,000.
133 and a third of what's the average weekly wage?
Let me pull that up. Just had that. Here it is. Okay.
Senator, I know you've
the average weekly wage.
I know you've been working.
The average weekly wage is determined annually by the Division of Labor.
Okay, Senator, what I'm getting at is
currently it would result 133% at 200 weeks is $206,149.51, or it's $1,030.75 a week.
Okay. And how did all this work prior to 2005. Is that what they got?
I am not sure.
Well, they sue the manufacturer?
If it was covered under workers' compensation. I am not sure. I can't answer what the process was prior to 2005.
But they would have still had some civil ability.
Under occupational disease.
They would have still had some civil remedy
in cases
of the manufacturer, right?
In cases of neglect. I don't know what the...
Okay. And the bill removes...
You know, for other incidents of death that were caused out of workplace injury, it's 66 and two-thirds of the average weekly wage.
Okay.
66 2/3% is what someone who has the misfortune of dying at work today from a workplace injury, that their family would receive, or their spouse or dependents up to the age of 18, their spouse for life, if they don't remarry, would receive 66 2/3% of the average weekly wage.
Okay, and you, did I hear you correctly, that's about $200,000?
No, that amount is, 66 2/3 is $28,140 per year. Under the 133% is $1,030.75 a week. Run that out at 200 weeks, that's the $206,000 and change number.
Okay, walk through the distinction between the $28,000 and the $200,000.
Okay, well, we're creating, the $28,000 is everyone else under workers' compensation outside of toxic exposure cases.
Okay.
Okay. That's what anyone who dies from a workplace injury, their spouse and or dependents would receive. Okay.
What is the
enhanced benefit is only for these cases where there is a terminal toxic exposure. A toxic exposure that results in death. And they will receive, the estate would receive a minimum of 200 weeks at 133%.
Senator, let me ask you.
Plus.
Okay.
Plus, the person who's contracted disease while they're living would also, they would also receive the total disability payments. And you also, the senator's, from CAPE's subrogation language is in the substitute as well. So that's not additional, but their employer could not come back and recover any cost of medical care. Medical care would also be covered for those claimants as well, and that was also in the governor's letter.
Okay. Did we in any of the negotiations on this bill, when I say negotiations, I don't know to what extent you did. You were kind enough to invite me to a couple meetings. I appreciate that. But did we get it in? Did, when you say that you've had discussions and we have the governor's letter of what he might sign, did we get in? You're not purporting that the financial definition of enhanced is something that we all agreed upon, right?
Correct.
I mean, I remember this number from a couple of months ago, you know, came from a business entity of how to define this.
Right.
But clearly there would be...
I mean, I
don't know. I guess it comes... Enhanced benefit is probably would be determined by the worker who has the horrific disease differently than someone else, So... That definition of enhanced benefit, it's not like the bill in front of us in this substitute.
I mean, we're trying to create something to try to accommodate the governor's concerns. The bill, we passed a bill that we thought addressed this issue. The governor vetoed it. I'm trying to find a middle ground
Well, Senator, as you know, I've worked in good faith with you. You've worked in good faith with me. And I, you know, this is a bill we should not pass in 20 minutes without, and I know that's not your intent. But let's get that out of the way. But let's walk through these steps real carefully.
Okay.
Last year, as you know, the Senate, in a conference committee with the House, said, we're going to deal with co-employee. Some in the business community said that wasn't good enough. I get that. It's my understanding, and I hope we can find this, but my understanding that one of the companies that's a major utility just won in court on their case. So it gets back to, because we have litigation, I understand that the business community, employers, and others step forward to say, we need remedy, you know, the civil courts, you know, there's a lack of certainty now in workers' comp. I get all that. They have a right to be at that debate.
Well, you have all the other occupational
disease, but I don't know where,
or, excuse me, all the other occupational disease cases like carpal tunnel and that, those are all having to go to civil court as well. So there's a benefit. The workers' compensation system was created to try to, in a timetable that, you know, number one, to provide the remedy so the business buys insurance coverage so that so that the claimant can get relief, and they do it in a time frame, whereas it would be much longer to try to go to civil court and get any judgment, and then you got to go try to collect. So, I mean, there's a reason why we created the workers' compensation system to take care of workplace injuries, and it was to provide some benefits to the business, but also to the employee as well.
No, I get the balance. You and I maybe agree with some of it, maybe don't. You've got a substitute in front of you that is a departure from where we ended last year. I get that.
Okay.
You were totally up front last year, and I guess I get down to now, instead of what we had last year, we're putting these all under comp, and we up the funeral payment to the family, and we do that. And that individual that is part of this debate that may have that toxic disease, in the status quo, if they live in a neighborhood, they can sue the manufacturer. But we're removing and putting them and defining in a very narrow way their rights under that bill.
Well,
is there a balance there? Absolutely, Senator.
Where it was an intentional act, or, you know, beyond gross negligence.
I get it, but the reality is,
still go to civil court.
The reality is what we have as. In this, the substitute defines enhanced benefit as 133 1/3%, you know, the
200 weeks.
200 weeks, and that's about 200. And I just want to have, I want to walk very carefully through all these steps before we change that.
Okay.
And we're departing from the status quo. We're departing from the world prior to 2005, and now we're departing from the world post 2005. Can we find some sort of balance between that worker, their employer, the need? I get it. But if you're wondering where I'm coming from on the bill, I want to make it clear to the body, this is, in this substitute, your current definition of enhanced benefit. And as we walk through some of these issues in the bill, I get that. You're making a fair argument. I disagree with it, but you're making a fair argument. And I want the body to realize what we're changing, and if they're comfortable with this.
If who's comfortable?
If the body is comfortable with you know, the definition of enhanced benefit. And you know, that's, you well know, I don't need to tell you, that's how we walk through these things, but.
Sure.
This is a bill I want to walk through, and, you know, I'm happy to be.
Yeah, I mean, we're creating a carve-out where it doesn't exist anywhere else in the country, but we're trying to do that to address concerns that the governor has raised.
Okay. I just wanted to make it clear that this, as often happens in this building, this substitute in front of us is the product of your take on the issue. It's not the product where you have tried to accommodate objections you've heard to the bill. It is not some global agreement that everyone has agreed to. I just wanted to make that kind of clear.
Yeah, I'm not portrayed it as such.
You did not portray it that way, and I'm not suggesting you did. I just want to make it clear when people say, well, we got the governor's letter. I just want them to understand in the detail of the letter, a definition of enhanced benefit, a definition of whatever, might be different to some, and I'm letting you know it's probably different to me.
Well, the easiest thing would have been for the governor to say, this is what I'll sign, this is what I won't sign. But he didn't. He didn't
right.
do that.
I get it. And his objections are his objections. They may not be mine. But 2 months ago, when we talked about the bill, this definition was from one side of the debate in how to define enhanced benefit. That's all I wanted to establish. Senator, thank you for the inquiry.
Quite all
right. I just wanted to go a little bit in detail. If you don't mind, I will probably ask you other questions throughout the course of the bill.
Sure.
Thank you.
Does any other senator wish to be heard? Senator from 13th. Send your amendment forward, sir.
It has been distributed, so I ask for a waiver of the reading. It is 0.05S. I have changed the amendment to read Senate substitute.
The reading will be waived as the amendment has been distributed. Proceed, Senator.
I move for the adoption of the amendment. Basically, this amendment allows the Division of Workers' Comp to determine the manner in which an application is made for hearings on compensation disputes, the manner in which notices for failure to prosecute are sent to those other employees. It allows documents relating to the outcome of hearings and notices to be sent by electronic means to the parties in dispute and the employer's insurer when the employee has representation. This is just, it's been distributed. This is an issue that's been brought to me. It's in a piece of legislation which passed in the House, but at this stage, I don't know if that legislation is passing, and it's just something to make the process work more efficiently for both the injured employee, the insured, the employer, and the department.
Does any senator wish to be heard on the motion of the senator from 13th? Senator from the 11th?
13th.
Does the senator yield? Does the senator yield?
Yes.
Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, I had to go briefly by the table while you were explaining your amendment. Can you just walk through it real briefly with me?
It's a piece of legislation which passed the House, and it basically is it relates to workers' comp, and it allows the division to determine the manner in which an application is made for hearings on compensation disputes and the manner in which notices for failure to prosecute are sent to those other than the employees. It brings the division a little more into the 21st electronic century.
I'm sorry, say again.
It brings the division in 21st electronic century.
Okay. So, it does. You don't go into anything.
I'm not. I'm going to inquire of you on some of
but
these
you
other
don't go,
issues.
You, I just want. You're not dealing with any of the major areas of disagreement in the bill, right? With this amendment. Okay.
That
All
is
right.
correct. I do have other questions about it, but before I went out there, I wanted to bring this issue while it was still fresh in my mind.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Does any other senator wish to be heard on the motion of the senator from 13th on the amendment? Seeing none, the senator is recognized to close.
No. Just kidding. I renew my motion.
Senator, may the chair inquire of you. Were you going to refuse to close?
I was trying to bring a little humor this Monday because there was so much humor lacking last Monday.
Thank you, Senator. You were recognized and you did close. As many as are of the opinion that motion shall be agreed to, say aye. Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The amendment is adopted. Senator from 13th.
I want to inquire the senator from the 11th.
Senator from the 11th, do you yield?
I yield, Mr. President.
Proceed.
Senator, I want to go through this piece of legislation with you before I go through it with the senator from the 23rd. And I really haven't had a chance to see. Go ahead. You look like you're ready to tell me something.
I don't want to interrupt. My last 5 days, I've got 97 and a half hours. I'm not going to interrupt you.
Why change?
You would need the senator. You would need the senator from Jefferson to show up and interrupt the great interrupter of conversations.
Senator,
who then alleges that you interrupt conversations. Ironically, he's the one who interrupts mid-sentence.
You just interrupted me, so just go back to your old ways.
You asked me.
Three issues we're dealing with: workers' compensation. We're dealing with occupational disease. We're dealing with co-employee liability. The three issues globally in the second injury fund. We've had several bills last year. We've had several bills this year. The issue dealing with occupational disease and co-employee liability was what was in the piece of legislation which passed earlier this year. Second injury fund was out. Now, in this piece of legislation, I guess the one thing it seems everyone, not everyone, but pursuit of a workers' comp bill is we are not going to deal with a second injury fund issue this year. I'm inquiring of you.
I heard. I did. There was just some. Go ahead.
Second injury is not in here. You just went through an inquiry with the senator from the 23rd.
Right.
The co-employee language that was agreed upon with the senator from Lawrence, that language is in this bill, and that was that language, correct?
My understanding, I didn't look. I'm not faulting the senator from 23rd, but this sub just landed on our desk. I long for one of those charts that shows what all this means, and I tried to walk in that definition verbally with the senator from 23rd of, okay, where are we at now? Where does this take us? How are we defining enhanced benefit? And I don't know if you heard that inquiry, but 133 and a third.
Yeah, I
times
that.
200 weeks. I mean, you're talking about it's around $200,000.
Now,
what the other point I wanted to make with you goes back to the committee that we were at, which is I thought some of the most compelling testimony was from the person who, now, was Senator Teed in your district? Is that right?
Thurton Teed had parts of its plant in my district,
right,
and parts
and
outside.
I'm not raising that as, you know, they had a plant, there were issues with this. But I thought it was compelling that when in testimony they said, look, under that version of the bill, you could pursue, if you lived in a neighborhood, you could sue that company. If you worked and manufactured it, you'd get your funeral paid for.
Yes. That is the issue. Yes. The people surrounding the community, and actually CertainTeed with their covering with the asbestos was actually in a creek. So a lot of the neighbors are currently suing them civilly due to the asbestosis and mesothelioma and the lung disease. But we are putting occupational disease as a whole, and I guess you would prefer I inquire the senator from the 23rd because I'm inquiring.
No, we have a senator.
I'm inquiring of you of what's in the bill, and you just received the bill too, so you will probably not have the accurate answers to the questions.
I wanted to let you know that I had tried to go, and you know, I look, the senator from 23rd is very busy. This bill, I don't know what the intent is on passing it, but he has shared very openly other versions of this. This version only is altered a couple places, but we haven't really gone down and we haven't worked it out in detail how what all the definitions of these mean. I know it says that, but we don't have a chart saying this is what this 133 and a third, and that's why I wanted to get to that. The other issue that's more global that you brought up is my understanding, even though this wasn't a case last year, is you brought up the fact the second injury fund, which is somewhat ancillary related to all this, is not in this bill. And I maybe misunderstood, but last month, Senator, in the committee you and I serve on, I thought there was a desire to put all of these in the same bill. Now, I don't know if that changed. That was not some major issue to me, but I know the senator from Stoddard, I believe, had a bill, as maybe the senator from Cape, that combined all the issues. So we have separated this. And as you well know, going back to last year, this issue was the body stuck with a conference committee report that just dealt with the co-employee language.
Senator from the 8th, we have certain rules on entering and egress. Please follow the Senate rules and follow Senate decorum. I'm so, sorry, Senator. Proceed.
So to answer your question, that's
Senator,
where...
Senator, I'll tell you what, if our colleagues can't play by the rules while we're in debate, I don't know where we're going to go this final week of session.
96 hours left. Anyway, 98 hours. Senator, I'm trying to bring you up to speed to where, and I know you probably get, but that's how I see where we're at now. I also wanted to make it clear, and I'm not suggesting that the senator from 23rd, to be fair to him, purported that this is some grand deal. I just wanted to make it clear. He read the governor's letter that talked about enhanced benefit, and this is his attempt, and perhaps others, to address that concern. My problem is I'm not sure that we have completely left the territory of leaving that worker behind and their family. I do like the fact that he does address the beneficiaries. I like the senator from Capes, going back to last year, issues on subrogation. So there are elements, but I'm not sure that we're there to the point where I'm comfortable leaving this worker and their family behind with all the issues involved in this environment.
Where is the issue that the senator from the 23rd was talking to you about, a possibility of you bringing that issue and him listening to the will of the body?
I don't know. I'll have to get a note. He related that he had talked to our staff person about, you know, and senator from 23rd has shared these substitutes with to talk about, you know, so that we can go over some of the issues from our perspective. But I don't know. The senator from 23rd did not talk to me. I believe his staff member probably talked to my staff member about some concern they had. I when I was over briefly to pick up something at the staff table, I didn't have time to get into that.
Dealing with one of the issues the governor stated in his letter, in dealing with the first page of the substitute, is used in this chapter, the term enhanced remedy is hereby defined, and then it lists all the different types of exposures.
Right.
When I think of benzene, I think of that in Berlinium. I think of that movie with John Travolta. Can't think of it. Based on a true story where he took a chemical manufacturing plant to court, lost his practice and everything. Civil action? What was the one with Gene Hackman and he was a trial attorney? No. That was when he was a defense attorney. Let me explain to you the difference between
the trial
attorney and
defense
attorney.
You're talking about the car manufacturer case.
No, there was one with Gene Hackman and his daughter was a trial attorney.
Yeah, the car manufacturer case.
Yeah, Bean County.
They found the engineer and he showed up in court at the end and said, yeah, they knew it was going to happen.
Senator, the inquiries with the senator from the 11th, not senator from Cape or the 23rd. Proceed.
It was.
Well, I know you enjoy movies. We ought to go through all of the movies we've seen the last 15 years. I did not get to see the one comic book movie that came out, broke records this past week, too. The Avengers.
I haven't seen that yet.
I wonder if they'd be covered with occupational disease if they wreck while they're saving the world.
Yeah.
All right.
Senator, to answer your question, I know you were interacting with other people on the floor, but if you want to go back to the
If you're going to interrupt me when I inquire of you, I'm going to interact with other people on the floor when you inquire of me.
Well, maybe it's difficult for me
Isn't
to determine
so
who you're talking to.
Isn't it so much nicer in this building when we are so cheerful and jolly?
Senator, don't you have to be in conversation with someone in order for you to interrupt them? When you have conversations with four other people, how do I know if I'm interrupting or not?
Senator, I can multitask.
The movie was class action, by the way.
Class action, yes.
Now,
getting to...
And that was unlike a civil act, which was John Travolta, where the H.R. Grace was dumping stuff.
Took on in pretty much mortgage.
Okay, let me get back to your question. The amendment provides that a settlement of enhanced benefit cannot require the relatives of the worker to waive death benefits.
Where I'm getting to first, starting with the substitute, the diseases and the compounds and the chemicals that have been in discussion with the occupational disease, are they all listed in the definition? I guess what I'm trying to do is go down the substitute. Is the definition of what is going to be an enhanced remedy for an occupational disease, does that take care of all of the ones that...
My answer is I have no idea. I assume they based it on something. But I don't know what's accurate.
I need to ask a question about that.
I think they're trying to create... my guess would be they're trying to be as specific as possible to avoid the carpal tunnel and other things that...
Right, I think you and I have discussed it all the time that there's a difference between carpal tunnel and lung cancer.
But they also have a modification in here that it's the primary cause of death. I don't know about, I'm not a doctor, but I doubt that carpal tunnel, while having consequences, would cause death. I don't know. But the answer to your question is I don't know where...
How do we define primary, do you know?
There's probably, I'm guessing, precedent somehow... It's like prevailing.
Prevailing, primary.
Prevailing would be, you know, we changed comp from, what was it before?
The prevailing factor to the prevailing
factor. Or it was a substantial. Didn't they have substantial?
A substantial to the substantial.
Substantial was shifted to prevailing?
Yes.
So I would guess... I don't know what the definition of primary is.
You and I, after fighting on this work comp issue, you for 9 years and I for 8 years, we automatically should get a law degree.
I don't know about that. Senator, I guess, and I'm probably misspeaking, but just my Independence, Missouri version of it would be prevailing probably roughly refers to 51% or, you know, a majority. Somehow, if you can determine that. Primary, I would guess. Probably in some of these mesothelioma cases, as you know, they find them late in life. I'm sure that the defense side shows up and says, well, the individual also smoked. The individual also was overweight, you know, whatever, and you can't prove. So I'm guessing that primary refers to majority somehow, maybe.
You go, I concur, you go down to line 14 where in disability shall be stated within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. Do you have an idea of what our definition of medical certainty is?
I don't know about medical certainty. I would assume when he goes on later and talks about subjective, you might want to get to that next sentence.
Objective medical findings shall prevail over subjective medical findings.
I assume that refers to a test rather than, in my opinion, I would guess, you deal with that in comp. Right. And when the bill in 2005, that objective findings, if you remember that.
Are those findings?
If you remember that from 2005, that was a bigger deal in soft tissue and things like that don't per se show up in a test always. If you remember that whole discussion in 2005, that the senator from 7th at the time was obsessed with that it was a test and all that. And I assume prevailing and all that are the main factor, I guess, however you define main, I guess. But this goes back to the objective findings. I'm sure in the civil environment, you have doctors who probably are more sympathetic to saying that this will do this, and I assume that language is that you've got to have some sort of scientific objective definition of these diseases, right?
Yes. I guess that's where it's going, because there's a lot of, I think, language.
I just remember, if you remember, John Loudon in 2005 and his staff person were obsessed in workers' comp.
His staff person, picking on him, reminded me of the movie Boys in Brazil or Boys of Brazil.
I remember he had a webpage or something, did reenactments. But and I always like to remind people when we walk through these issues on comp, he also wrote the workers' comp statute for the state of Missouri. Feel good about that. But if you remember, there was an obsession about people faking a work injury, and that happens, and workers' comp fraud, which that happens. And so I just remember the whole discussion about objective medical finding as trying to address that. I assume when it's revisited here that you would have to have somebody have a complete diagnosis of this. I'm guessing that the definitive causal links of cancer, of all those things, that they could medically walk in and say it was beryllium, asbestos, etc., that caused this. That would be my drive-by view of the thing.
There's more questions on that, because then if you go further down, a disease with an enhanced remedy shall not include any injury or disease under subsections, and they list them, and it goes to subsection 7. Now you turn to subsection 7, the new 7, and it's on page 4. That would exclude disease of lungs or respiratory tract, hypertension, and or disease of the heart or cardiovascular system, including carcinoma, may be recognized as occupational diseases for the purposes of this chapter and are defined to the disability due to the exposure of smoke gases, carcinogens, inadequate oxygen of paid firefighters. Is this exemption there just to exempt the firefighters from this new enhanced remedy, as I'm reading it, because it lists subsection 7?
Where are you at in the bill? You've left.
Okay, you look
two.
On page 2,
okay.
Line 21.
Oh, okay.
And it defines subsections, and then subsection 7, which is on page 4, the new subsection 7. So that is being excluded from the enhanced remedy, is how I am reading it.
A disease with an enhanced remedy shall not include any injury or disease under sections 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of this section.
Okay, and then that is page 4. It's got the repetitive motion in it and several of the other ones that we have talked about, but it also has disease of the lungs or respiratory tract.
And where are you getting that it would be that this would be
page
a firefighter?
4, that's subsection 7.
Which of the subsections relate to firefighters?
Subsection 7. Read the entire subsection.
Okay. And then?
I'm thinking maybe you could still get exemptions under the current enhanced remedy with that exception in it.
Well, and then it continues, a disease with an enhanced remedy shall not be subject to attorney fees otherwise provided for in this chapter.
Where'd you go to?
That's line 21. It's right after your sentence.
Okay, yeah. A disease with an enhanced remedy shall not be subject to attorney fees otherwise provided for this chapter. I'm trying to line out several of the problems that I have questioning you, and I'll keep questioning several others on it. When I'm bringing up these issues, I once again go back to the amendment that staff is working on. Are we that far? We're not ready to do some of these changes.
I don't know. What are you referring to, the staff amendment?
Once again, the senator from the 23rd year inquiry said his staff had mentioned to your staff about some changes and then bringing those changes up on the floor and allowing the will of the body. Are some of those changes, some of these issues I have brought up to you in the last 20 minutes in this inquiry?
Probably the issues that I was going to relate to were dealt with enhanced benefit, dealt with where we're at in extending this. So that's what I was going to go at, but given the history of where this body has been on this issue, I'm not, wild about passing this in an hour.
No, I think also given the history, a lot of times they don't listen to the
Senator. This body passed a bill last year. We passed a conference.
What was all in that bill? Two of the issues, or was it just occupation?
No, it went back to the co-employee, I believe. And that's what we did. We just brought it back to there.
Well, there's a few issues you want to bring up that I'm sure you're wanting to work with staff. I want to inquire the senator from Lawrence on a few of these issues, if you don't mind.
That would be great.
Mr. President, can I inquire the senator from Lawrence?
Senator from 13th. The senator from Lawrence is not on the floor. Sergeant at Arms, please summons the senator from Lawrence. Senator from Lawrence, the senator from the 13th would like to have an inquiry with you. Do you yield?
I do yield.
He does. Proceed.
Before I begin my inquiry, I just want to let you know, I think a week ago I stood up on the floor and gave you accolades about a nice editorial that you received in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, you being very conservative from Southwest Missouri, receiving a very nice editorial in the liberalized media of the Post-Dispatch, so many people say. So today I'm reading the weekly St. Louis Business Journal. And on the back there's an article. I'm in the article as well as you, but you lead the article.
I what?
You're the lead-in of the article. Okay. You get about 10 paragraphs. I got one.
What was that about? Do I even want to know?
It's about what a great senator you are.
Sincerely. Well, that's nice.
Yes, so I'm just trying to let you know that St. Louis media is finally realizing your potential, and here you're going to go back to Southwest Missouri.
Sounds like I was just 10 paragraphs of build up to the grand finale is probably what I was.
Senator, you handled last year, and then we passed a bill this year and I know you were somewhat involved with it this year, is the issue of co-employee liability.
Yes.
The issue of the co-employee liability, I believe, is on page 5.
Correct.
And is that verbatim what has changed, or has some of the wording since changed as well? Is that
I believe it's so verbatim from 572. Is it not? I looked back this morning, or this afternoon, I guess, when I got this, and I had been provided with a copy. I'd read 05F before, so I read through 07F when it came to the desk, and I think it's the same, but let's go through it again in case I'm wrong.
It starts at the bottom of page 4. Any employee of such employer shall not be liable for any injury or death for which compensation is recoverable under this chapter, and every employer and employees of such employer shall be released from all other liability, therefore whatsoever, whether to the employee or any other person, except that an employee shall not be released from liability for injury or death if the employee engaged in an affirmative negligent act that purposefully and dangerously caused or increased the risk of the injury.
I have here 572, which was the vetoed bill, and I read through it earlier and then also just now as you were reading it, and it matches with 1403, the substitute that's in front of us, 07F.
And that was the so-called totally agreed upon piece of legislation. Was 572, refresh my, that also had the occupational disease, but nothing in the second injury, correct?
I think that's right, yes. Well, I think that's right. It's been a while.
You know, it's amazing from Thursday to Monday how much you forget.
Sometimes it's deliberate.
Deliberate. It also discusses your social endeavors in Jefferson City in that article as well. The Four Musketeers. Senator from Jefferson, the senator from the 10th, and the senator from the 15th. It's very nice.
Well, I will
read
it.
You're kind of worried, giving me the worried look that they discuss. They did conservative, moderate Republican, moderate Democrat, liberal Democrat. That's how they kind of listed you in the article, which is accurate. And it's
probably accurate.
Okay. I wanted to make sure of that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. President.
Senator from the 13th.
Can I inquire the senator from Cape Girardeau?
Senator from Cape Girardeau. Do you yield?
I yield.
He does. Proceed.
In the discussion, thank you for yielding, Senator. In the discussion from the senator from the 23rd and the senator from the 11th, the issue that you dealt with, that I believe it was due to the fact you have constituents, that you used the example of the popcorn manufacturer. Where in this substitute is that language that was stated that it was in this substitute?
Page 11, number 7, lines 15 through 28.
Can you go through that with me?
Basically, what that would do, when an individual is harmed and they are harmed in the employer, workplace, the exclusive remedy at law is workers' compensation against the employer. It is not the exclusive remedy against any other third parties that may have been there. Take the example of Gilster Mary Lee and the popcorn cases. This is basically, if you'll look over at the beginning, one of the diseases, it's myeloplastic syndrome. That's popcorn disease. That's the big word name. And basically, if you wanted to sue the employer, you were barred in civil court. Your exclusive remedy is workers' compensation. But if you believe that there weren't proper warnings, there weren't proper instructions, there weren't proper packaging, there were design defects of any of the materials that were utilized in that process, in this particular case, the flavoring of the popcorn did not, or the allegations were that the flavoring of the popcorn did not contain a warning and a recommendation of the type of filter that was necessary to make sure that that popcorn flavoring, when dealt with on the assembly line or the manufacturing process, was not ingested. So because that popcorn flavoring manufacturer was not the employer, the exclusive remedy did not apply, so that popcorn flavoring manufacturer could be brought into an independent civil suit for inadequate warning, failure to warn, a number of different allegations. If that lawsuit is taken to trial and an award is given in a civil court, or if that case is settled, under existing law as it is now, the employer who expended resources in a workers' compensation setting would have a dollar-for-dollar credit offset entitlement to the proceeds from that third-party action to reimburse him or her as the employer for all of the costs that they expended in the workers' compensation setting, medical bills or PPD payments or anything else along those lines. So as a final example in continuation of our discussion, I spend $100,000 on my employee through the workers' compensation system. That employee's family or estate brings a lawsuit saying that the popcorn flavoring company failed to warn of the potential hazards with ingesting that flavoring. They get a settlement in civil court for $200,000. As soon as that $200,000 is turned over by either the insurance company or a self-insured manufacturer or company, the employer that expended the $100,000 need only say, here's my certified copy of expenditures for medical bills in the workers' compensation case. I am now suing the family for offset under current law. What this provision would do and is designed to do, and the best wordsmithing that I could come up with, is to say that in that particular scenario that I just laid out, that employer would no longer have what's called subrogation rights to offset his or her expenditures or its expenditures in the workers' compensation case.
I had other inquiries, but I think the Senator from 23rd is going to make a motion. So at this time, I relinquish the floor.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you please place that bill back on the informal calendar?
That bill will be placed on the informal calendar.
Thank you, Mr. President. We'll stay on that calendar. Would you recognize the Senator from Andrew for motion on House Bill 1361.
President.
Staying on the same calendar, the Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move that House Bill 1361 be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. If my staff is listening, if they could bring the folder down for House Bill 1361, the one they handed me was for 1051, that would be very helpful. I believe House Bill 1361 is the poll attachment. Stay on it. Can we stay on this? Okay. As I said, Mr. President, I have a substitute that should be on its way down. Essentially what House Bill 1361 does, if we could get... No, that's a good idea. Now you bring that up. I'm going to throw that over in a minute. All right. Okay. I have a Senate substitute, Mr. President. I will sign the substitute and send it forward.
Senator from Caldwell, please send those Senate substitutes forward. Have they been distributed?
If not, they should. They are being distributed. Yes, they have them. They are going to distribute those. I speak, it looks like. I would move for the adoption of the Senate substitute. Essentially, what the Senate substitute for House Bill 1361 does is it begins to address the challenges that we are having in our state in terms of pole attachment for broadband services. Right now, if an electric co-op, if poles are owned by an electric co-op, there is no guiding statute by which someone who wishes to attach to them must follow. And what I mean by this is if the poles are owned by Ameren or Kansas City Power and Light, or I believe even Empire, there are already guidelines in place on how they have to, how the process works, notification in terms of cost sharing, all of those types of things. Right now, none of that is true for the co-ops because co-ops do not fall under the Public Service Commission. What we are trying to do, this actually was an issue that came up two sessions ago, I believe. It came up in discussion of the broadband, and right now what has happened is throughout our state there have been many co-ops that have started deploying fiber optic cable broadband services throughout the rural parts of our state. As they have done that, there's come into question whether or not and how those attachments should be working. This legislation begins to bring some clarity to that. We worked on it last year. We were unable to get it completed. To be very candid, we continued to have disagreements between the cable companies and the co-ops. We decided to give them the interim to try to work through this, to get this brought to closure. It is my belief and understanding there was little work done in the interim, and unfortunately, they did not get this resolved. At the beginning of the year, we once again started this process. We have worked with all parties involved throughout this entire time. At the end of the day, I thought we had an agreement in concept, and then late last week, the cable providers tried to add a couple more pages of language that completely threw the deal out of whack and were by no means even reasonable requests. Where we are today is I have taken input from both sides, all the different groups, which are the telecom providers, which are the cable companies, and the electric co-ops. I have put together this substitute to try to reach a reasonable balance between all of this, and this is what we're moving forward with. Basically, what this bill would do, this bill would ensure that broadband providers who would enter into an agreement with the utility provider, i.e., whoever owns the poles, for the attachment of those lines. The provider that is seeking the attachment to the pole needs to have a written agreement in place with the pole owner before they move forward. And basically, what has happened, right, wrong, indifferent, over time, the evolution that has occurred here is that we have over 800 attachments throughout the state that are not legal, meaning whoever it is, whether it's a telephone company, a cable company, whoever it is, have attached to a pole without prior consent, without paying rent. And no one knows why or how this occurred, but the reality is that is the situation that we are now within. If the two parties are not able to get to an agreement within a predetermined time frame, it's either 45 or 60 days, I forget which, then what happens is it's actually referred into
I'll leave it up to you.
Arbitration, mediation, a third party to work it out. If they cannot get to resolution there, once resolution is brought either by the pole owner or by the mediator, either party can appeal that to the courts. So what we've tried to do is create a mechanism by which the process moves forward. We have a drop-dead date or a date certain where the let's just use in this particular case, the co-op can't drag this on forever so that the cable company could never come and compete with them, that at some point there's a drop-dead date that they either have to go to arbitration to get it resolved or a court finalizes it, but then everyone is made whole and they're moving forward. If they cannot get to an agreement, until they get to that agreement, no one can attach anything to the poles. The pole owner must let the attaching service provider know whether or not any modifications are necessary before the attachments can be made. And the theory behind that is if you go out and you're going to put fiber and you're going to, let's say you're going to attach to 200 poles, part of those poles may need to be changed out. They may need to be raised depending on where they are, what they're used for, that type of a thing. And so whoever owns the poles needs to let the attaching person know. And then from that point forward, once they are attached, everyone on that pole will share equally in cost, and everyone attached to that pole, by giving the notice that ensures the liability for the provider that is attaching to the pole. This also goes on and establishes a process to address the unauthorized attachments that are in place today. And actually, upon the provider that is currently on there, so it forces resolution of those who attached and shouldn't have. And then, once again, the way that provision will work, because that's important, if the two parties cannot come to an agreement on that, then what they actually have to do is either within, again, a 45 to 60 day window, they are pushed into arbitration. If they can't get to an agreement there, then once again, a court will ultimately decide. So what we're trying to do is take the timelines out of this, force the issue to be dealt with. The reason this bill is important and the reason that we need to get this resolved this year is throughout our state, we have broadband deployment going on in the rural parts of our state. And in not all cases, but in many cases, this is being done so that actually folks like my parents who live 5 miles from a town of 10,000, they cannot get high-speed internet today from their telephone provider. They are going to have the option or the ability to get it through the electric company or the rural co-op if we pass this legislation and they can continue their broadband deployment. So for, you know, the last 10 years as broadband's been deployed, the telephone company didn't serve my mom and dad. The cable company is nowhere near serving my mom and dad. The rural electric co-op would like to serve my mom and dad, but we got to make sure that they can do the pole attachments accordingly. With that, Mr. President, I think the only other major issue, which I think is an important one, is that we need to talk about the rights of the property owners. And this is one that we worked through extensively, specifically with Farm Bureau and some of the groups that were very interested in making sure that the property rights were taken care of and the owners were made whole. And this act specifically provides that for any easement or right-of-way acquired by a pole owner before August 28th of 2006 for the location of its poles, the pole owner does not have to go back and get permission to add additional services, i.e. broadband, to this. The reason August 28th of 2006 is the key date there is because that is when we dealt with eminent domain the last time in the legislative body, and so anything from August 28th of 2006 forward, it will already be taken care of under those provisions. And most importantly, the act does not limit the property owner's right for compensation for damages if as they're putting in the additional attachments, et cetera. With that, Mr. President, I renew my motion and look forward to answering any questions.
The senator from Harrison moves the adoption of the Senate substitute for House Bill 1361. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Senator from the first, what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. To inquire the senator from Mercer.
Senator from Davies, do you yield?
Sure,
he does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. So let's start with the issue of property rights.
Yep.
So where do you deal with that in the bill?
I need a copy of the...
Of your sub?
The most recent sub, yeah.
Let me ask you a question while we're looking for that. You made reference to the date of 2006 and the changes that we made in the eminent domain law at that time. How do those changes address, you know, concerns about property rights?
Well, when the new law was put in place, from that point forward, it's already addressed under current statute. I don't know exactly off the top of my head. I know that it was not an issue. No one was worried about what happened after August 28th of 2006. The concern was dealing with all of those before that.
All right. So let's say that we have one of your constituents, because this is an issue that really is more of a rural issue.
Sure.
Yeah. Let's say that we have one of your constituents that has gone into an agreement with a co-op as far as the pole being on their land.
Right. And there's two different types to think about here. You have your you have your poles that are
Thank
on
you.
Private property, and you have your poles that are in public right-of-ways or the easements that are there for public good. So what we are talking about here are ones that are on private property. So it's coming out of a public easement and maybe going to an individual's house or to an individual's shed, or, you know, it cuts across a series of privately held land to get from point A to point B.
Okay. So back to your constituent on their private property. They've made an agreement since 2006 with...
Oh, before 2006.
No, let's start with those that made it since 2006.
Okay.
All right. And they've gone into that agreement with a co-op, all right? And since 2006, because they're... And by the way, what's going on with this expansion of broadband is being done through federal grants. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So there's been a lot of activity, you know, along this lines, you know, as far as trying to expand broadband across the state of Missouri.
Right.
Correct? So... Right. Now we find out, as you mentioned, 800 to 900 attachments to poles where, for some strange reason, whether it be, a phone company or a cable company or whatever the case may be.
That's right.
They went out and attached to a pole that they didn't own. I don't understand that. I mean, I'm in your committee. I serve on your committee, and it was a question I had.
Yeah.
Well, how in the world did that happen to begin with? That's... You know, a different issue. But now you've got this individual who has this pole on their private property, and now we've ID'd two or three different users that have attached to this pole. And are you telling me that now that we've identified them, that the property owner is locked in to an agreement that he made with one owner of the pole? I mean, he doesn't have the opportunity to renegotiate or something?
I believe there's a provision in there that allows a property owner to request, I believe it's $500 per mile. They can go back and say, listen, there are now, you now have broadband on, or there's two other providers, or whatever it is. There are provisions. I'm looking at it specifically on page 9. Specifically under Section 8 is where it talks about the additional compensation. And if you go back to...
Senator, yeah.
And if you go back to 7,
okay.
Page 8, Section 7, it also talks in there about nothing in this section shall be construed to deny a property owner reasonable compensation for any increased interference with blah, 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 blah. In the theory behind it is, to that point right there, this has been a tough one as we've, and here's why this has been difficult as we work through it. Right now, there are rural electric co-ops who through their electric cooperative have attached fiber to the poles, not for necessarily for just broadband issues. They actually attached the fiber prior to any of this federal grant money or federal stimulus stuff, because they are building, they are connecting their substations via fiber. So they're able to operate and monitor all their substations via a network now, done via fiber. And so they've gone through and put the fiber on the poles just to run, monitor, gather information, however you want to say it, about their own electrical network. Now, what that will ultimately allow as well is someday, as they move closer to having a smart grid technology, or as smart grid technology continues to move forward, they'll have that infrastructure in place. What we are trying to deal with, that's the more pressing issue, Senator, is this a true broadband deployment to consumers as they try to, for lack of a better term, as they try to actually drive broadband services to the rural parts of the state that don't have it today.
Okay. And along that lines, get back to your mom and dad.
Yeah.
Phone company, weren't getting them the high-speed
broadband.
The cable company wasn't doing it.
Well, you know, they live far enough out that there's no cable company close.
So now that the co-ops are doing it, is that who's getting that broadband to them?
That's right. Okay.
Have we addressed in this legislation, as we move forward, and in the spirit of competition, and the idea that as this infrastructure gets built out on the federal dime, on the taxpayer's dime,
sure,
right, we're getting grants to build out this infrastructure, and then competitors of the co-op want to go in there and buy for that business, for your mom and dad's business.
There is no competitor there today. There is no competitor.
Okay, what if there's a competitor there in 5 years?
Great, go. Because
But have we addressed in this legislation the ability so that one competitor can keep another competitor out of the market by keeping them off their poles?
Right. No, that's a great point. And yes, that is specifically what I meant. Two things. That's addressed in two ways. Number one, once the electric co-op puts an additional service on there, i.e. the fiber for broadband, then at that point there are federal laws that kick in that say that if once they use that pole for something other than their primary use, they have to allow anyone who wishes to attach.
Okay.
So once they decide that they're going to be a broadband provider, as well as an electric company,
right,
the day they do that, anybody who requests has the same rights to get on that pole. Which that also means is whatever rate that electric company charges its subsidiary for attachment. Yeah, the attaching rates for other companies have to be very similar. So,
okay. And where is that addressed in here, Senator?
I'm not sure that's actual federal law that ensures the attachment component. I'm not sure that's addressed in here. In here, the part that you talked about, though, which is even more important, is the component of can an electric co-op keep a cable company or a telephone company from attaching to their pole just to ensure that they can't compete? And what we did there was that's where we sent them to arbitration. So the concern raised by the cable companies was that, let's say in this case, you're the electric co-op. You decide to get into broadband. You start deploying. I come to you and I say, Senator, Mr. Co-op owner, I want to put fiber on your pole as well. Say, sure. And we start negotiating, and you drag this negotiation out, and you drag it out, and you drag it out, and you drag it out. At some point, whoever's negotiating to get onto the pole has to have a remedy to bring that to closure. And I believe that section is in, let's see if we can find the section here, Senator. Section In section 4 is what Rich says. Let's see if he knows what he's talking about. In page...
Parties cannot agree to...
Here's section 4. On page 5, if the parties cannot agree on any provision of the written agreement required under this section, including a reasonable poll attachment fee, either party may demand non-binding mediation. If mediation is unsuccessful in producing agreement on the disputed issue, the Rural District Cooperative poll owner shall decide the issue, provided that in the case of a disputed poll attachment fee, the fee shall comply with the limits set forth in subsection 3 of this section. If the attaching entity believes the poll attachment fee set by the Rural District Cooperative poll owner exceeds the standards provided in this section, or the attaching entity otherwise disputes the decision of the Rural District Cooperative poll owner, it may file a petition in the circuit court of any county in which the Rural District Cooperative poll owner maintains an office for the conduct of its business. Essentially, what I tried to do, Senator, is if they go to mediation and they can't work it out, someone's got to make a decision. That decision, in this particular case, is going to be made by the person who owns the polls. If the company trying to attach says, I don't like that deal, it's a bad deal, and here's why, A, B, and C, the remedy for them to get that resolved is circuit court. What I tried to keep from happening is the ability to just drag this thing out forever, because that's a legitimate concern. Now, the flip side to that, and where we got hung up, and the reason that we don't have an agreement yet, is 2 weeks ago now, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, all the parties came together, we sat down, we went through everything conceptually. Once we had it conceptually, I think we were there conceptually, everyone got up out of that room, I believe we were there conceptually, we had Senate staff draft the language. When we got the language back, we sent it out to all involved parties. The co-op sent back a couple of technical changes like commas and periods, nothing substantive. The telecom providers said they were okay with it. The concern of the cable companies were what you just articulated, what if they drag us out forever? What the cable companies wanted to do, because they sent us language back, and in their language what it said was, is if you and I couldn't agree, you own the polls, I, as the company who wants to attach to your polls, we couldn't get to an agreement that we have the mediation, we have court, but while those things were going on, I, as the attachee, get to go ahead and start putting my fiber on your polls. So we don't have an agreement. You own the property, in this case the polls, but for some reason, I, as the company who just wants to attach, have all the rights to come and, for lack of a better term, trespass on your property until we get to an agreement. Well, I don't know any business in any relationship anywhere that it works that way. And from their perspective, what they're arguing, which is a legitimate argument, is don't let these guys just drag it out on us forever. And that's why I put the two steps in there, the mediation. If you can't get to mediation, then let's take it to court and get it done in a fairly short time frame.
And so, again, do you believe, Senator, that maybe from their perspective, because of that infrastructure, that build-out, that if that came about from the taxpayers' money and from federal grants, that's why they might take that position?
I think the reason the cable companies took that position is because it's actually happening in other states. Like, they actually brought cases to us that in other states, co-ops are just dragging this thing out for months, if not years, to try to keep
what kind of time frame do you think we're looking at when you talk about the remedy that you've given them through mediation and then the circuit court?
At one time, I thought we actually had dates in there. We don't have dates now. At one time, we had talked about, you know, like a 45 or 60 day. I mean, we had actually talked about short time frames. So I don't know why we pulled that. Oh, because the way that we changed it when redrafted, is it allowed either side to request that action immediately. So you and I could have the first meeting, we'd get up and walk out, and I'd say, boy, there's no way he's going to let me attach to that pole. I'm not even going to waste my time negotiating with him, and I could ask for mediation immediately. We'd go to mediation, they would say, here's what you're going to do. I'd say, nope, I'm still not going to do it. I don't like that guy. I don't think he's treating me fair.
So you would have to make a decision.
Who are the mediators?
I don't know. Whoever the legal, I mean, that's determined through the legal process.
Okay.
So it's no different than any other business negotiation where a contract calls for mediation. So anyway,
would you be comfortable with the idea that when we talk about, you know, going through the circuit court, you know, having some kind of time certain?
I mean, if there's a way to do it, like a maximum? Yeah, I mean, if there's a way to do it, here's what I'm not comfortable with. I'm fine putting in whatever time frames we need to put in, assuming that they're reasonable. What I'm not comfortable doing is saying that during mediation or during a court case that the entity who wants to attach gets to go ahead and have all the rights and privileges and essentially trump the privileges of the owner of the polls. I'm not comfortable going that far. But anywhere up to that, I'm very open to your thoughts.
Thank you, Senator.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Further discussion. Senator from the 4th, what purpose do you rise?
Inquire the Senator from Nottoway.
Senator from Davies, do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. You perked my curiosity here about the one item that you are not comfortable with at all. The not allowing them to attach to the poll without
right.
a written agreement?
Yes.
And even though we know who it's going to be, because there's only two or three providers, and we know who owns the poll, which is the electric co-ops, and we know that we're trying to expand service throughout the state, so isn't really in the best interest to let them attach?
No.
And then, I mean, after they attach, it's just a matter of money.
It's not. There's liability issues. There's cost issues in terms of poll replacement. Because basically what happens is as they go out and they do a assessment of these polls, some of those polls may have been there for, let's say, 20 years. And they have the electric company on there and they have the telephone company on there. And now we're going to add, for this discussion's sake, the cable company.
Right.
Well, it might take a changing of the poll because of loading. You know, basically one of the things that they have to engineer for is ice storms, wind loads, those types of things. So it may actually take a change out of some of the polls. What my biggest concern is the reason I don't want to go ahead and allow them to start attaching yet is because even when they start attaching, there's still an engineering component, but even more importantly, the poll owner, i.e. in this case the electric co-op, still has all the liability if something happens. So if they start attaching and one of those poles break and fall over and someone drives into it or walks into it or whatever crazy stuff could happen, that liability is actually still on the electric co-op.
Yeah, but
that's my issue.
He's going to enjoin whoever.
But Senator, like let's talk through this for a minute. Let's say that I came to you. Let's say that you rent duplexes. And I come to you and I say, I want to rent your duplex. And you say, okay, I'll take $1,000 a month. I'm like, nope, I'm only willing to pay $500. What we're talking about right now is when I say I'm only willing to pay $500, in today's world, in a free market system, you say, sorry, I'm not going to do that. What I can say now is I want to go to binding arbitration, mediation. So you and I go to mediation. And the mediator says,
well, you've got mediation and binding arbitration.
That's right. It's not binding arbitration. It's non-binding. You're right.
Okay.
So we go, and the arbitrator says $600. That's going to be the rent. I say, okay, I'll take the deal. You're like, no way, I'm not taking the deal. At that point, I have the right to go to court, right, to continue this process. But what you're saying is throughout the mediation, throughout the negotiations, throughout the court case, I get to go ahead and move into your apartment.
Well, yeah.
And do whatever I want to do while
I'm
there.
No, I'll differ with you there because in my situation here, it's a monopoly. It's a public service. It's not an open and free market.
But wait a second. These are not monopolies. They're the only ones serving for a reason, Senator. No one would serve these areas. Rural co-ops exist for a reason. Because competitive markets do not exist, because no one, no one would build a business model to serve these areas. So the people who live in that area all put in money to establish a co-op. Thus the reason it exists. The mere definition of a co-op
is an area so dense that nobody, or so lack of density, that no one wants to serve it because the business model doesn't work.
Right.
That's why we have co-ops.
So what I'm afraid what your legislation's, I'm concerned with what your legislation's doing. Now we're going to have the electric co-ops come in and put their poles in. Then we'll have the cable come in and put their own poles in. And then we're going to have, who else? The telephone companies come in and put their own poles in.
So they've already got them.
We got more poles than the trees.
The telephone companies have poles. The electric co-ops have poles. I mean, no cable company is going to go put their poles in. If they won't put them in today, they wouldn't have put them in up until today. They're not going to put them in going forward. What this is really about, and this particular issue is about, this is, in my opinion, a debate about ownership rights and who owns the pole and who has the right to either attach or not attach while the court case and or mediation is going on. I'll tell you what, Senator, if you want to offer an amendment to force rural co-ops to allow cable companies to attach, because that's the only group complaining here is cable companies, if you want to offer that amendment, and we'll do a roll call vote on that, I'm willing to let the will of the body prevail.
No, I don't want to offer that amendment. But what I don't want to do is we're nationally and statewide, we're trying to expand broadband
right
throughout the state. Into the rural areas,
right?
The people that need it the most. And, you know, I'm concerned that what we're doing is we're slowing down the expansion.
How?
By tying up people that, by prohibiting other companies from coming in and letting them attach to the poles. I would imagine, what did you say, there was, how many poles, how many illegal attachments are
over
there?
Over 800 is what I'm being
800?
Told. Yeah.
I would imagine they don't even know.
What do you mean they don't know? Somebody had to go attach to that pole, and they knew they didn't have an agreement when they attached.
Well, yeah, you know,
whoever.
I don't know how it is where you live.
I don't buy this story that I just accidentally, my cable accidentally ended up on this pole, and I had no idea that it wasn't supposed to be there. They knew exactly what they were doing when they did it, but they also knew that no one ever checks it. They're not going to get caught, or they historically haven't gotten caught. And if they did get caught, nothing really happened to them. Everyone kind of worked together, and now it's all. And right, wrong, indifferent, Senator, it's all coming to a head here. And at some point, what's going to happen is if we don't bring resolution to this issue here, it's going to get done in a court.
Well,
and what's going to happen is rural co-ops are going to start suing cable companies for trespassing because they went and put their cable on poles that they have no right to be on today. That's the reality. Or telephone companies or whoever's on the pole, right?
Right.
And right, wrong, indifferent, I would like to believe that this body can bring resolution to that better and in a more conducive manner that facilitates what you and I were talking about, the broadband deployment piece of that.
That's my sole issue. Yeah. I just don't want to get in the way of that.
No,
and I'm thinking this probably does.
But I absolutely disagree that there's no way, shape, or form that this gets in the way of that. And at some point, these co-ops still own this property. It's their property. I mean, I cannot in good conscience come in here and pass a state law that trumps the rights, the property rights of that electric co-op because two cable companies in this state won't agree to anything that we've come up with. And every time we get to an agreement, they move the bar. I mean, this process, Senator, with all due respect, has been very frustrating because we have on numerous occasions thought we had an agreement.
Everything in this building is very frustrating.
That's a very good point. But there are times when people disagree in good faith, and you can understand where they're both coming from. To consistently have the ball moved on you time and time again is absolutely, it's just disappointing, is maybe the best way of saying it. And so what I'm just trying to get to, I agree with the fundamental argument is I don't want them to drag this out forever, but at the same time, if they can't get to an agreement, then at any time, literally day one, they can force this, either side can force this into mediation, and then if they don't like that result, they can force it into court. I don't know what else to do, Senator, to be honest.
Are there court cases pending now?
I think there are. I think there are court cases between cable companies and landowners. There are, I don't know how many court cases are out there. There are no court cases that I'm aware of, although maybe there are, where a cable company has attached and the electric co-op is suing to get them off. I don't think any of those lawsuits have started yet. I think if we do not get this done, those lawsuits are sure to start. But in the process of that, of those lawsuits happening, my mom and dad still can't get broadband services.
Well, and I'm glad you touched on that, because your mom and dad are going to get their high-speed internet from the electric co-op, right? Did you not say
well,
that?
Well, that will be the only place they'll have the option to get it, yes.
And they're the ones that own the pole.
That's correct.
So I don't understand how we make that connection. The electric co-op owns a pole. They're going to provide the broadband internet. I don't understand why there's – explain to me why they can't get internet.
What's that?
Explain.
Well, right now, the only thing on those poles is the electric wires.
Right.
There is no fiber on those poles today. And in where I live, in northwest Missouri, you have the electric co-op, and then they have a subsidiary, literally a different company, that does the broadband component.
Right.
So, but that company is just now starting to attach. So the electric co-op and the subsidiary company entered into an agreement for the subsidiary to attach to the pole at a predetermined price, and they are now putting the fiber on the poles.
But
so my mom.
But
and
they
dad
are going to do that regardless of this bill, right?
My mom and dad today. Nope. Well, yes and no.
Wait, it can't be both. They are or they aren't.
Well, what can happen is they can start doing it, and they have no problems as they go through the public right-of-ways. Where it gets more difficult is the uncertainty about whether or not they can get on poles that are in private right-of-ways, like, you know, private landowners.
Right, but
that's where it gets more cloudy.
Now you really
confused
me.
And it also gets more cloudy when, like, if the telephone company wants to attach. Like, one of the reasons the telecom carriers like this bill, believe it needs to get done, is because it brings certainty to the rate structure. The way it works today, the electric co-ops, as you know, do not fall under the Public Service Commission and from a regulatory environment. So there is no... there is no range, for lack of a better term, on what they can or can't charge. And so we actually bring some structure to that under here as well, so that they end up in the same alignment. Because what I didn't want to happen was I didn't want them to be able to come in and say, okay, we'll let you attach at 15 times the going rate. Like, that's not fair. That's not gonna facilitate broadband deployment.
Right, right.
So those are some of the provisions why other carriers think this is the right thing to do.
But in back to your mom and dad's case,
the
co-op owns the pole, the co-op owns the broadband company. This bill is not going to affect access to your mom and dad.
Well, my mom and dad get their internet today from the co-op via wireless,
right?
But it's limited on its throughput. So where this really has the ability to impact them is when the day comes where they actually have fiber to the home. That's when this actually can be part of it. Actually, my mom and dad are probably a bad example on
they probably don't even own a computer, right?
Well, what will happen is they'll go ahead and grant the easement. You know, they have, let's say, a half mile that is actually on their property of poles. Well, they don't care if they're not going to stick it to the co-op to get more money. They just want broadband services, which is what 98% of the people who live in these areas want.
Right.
So.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Further discussion. Senator from Buchanan, for what purpose do you rise?
To inquire of the Senator from Lynn.
Senator from Atchison, do you yield?
Yes, Mr.
He does
President.
Proceed.
Thank you. Senator, I've been told that there are rural electric cooperatives that have subsidiaries that are broadband providers.
Right, just like United up where we are.
And that's true, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And that the problem occurs when the REC says, no, you may not put our a line on here. We're not going to agree and provide you with a written agreement to say a new subdivision that's being built. And then the subsidiary then gets to put it in and therefore short circuit their opportunity. And that's sort of an anti-competitive thing.
Okay.
Is that true?
I've never heard of that scenario happening, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
Well, that's the scenario that was explained to me.
Right, which is why I addressed that in here.
It was also told to me that no other state requires a written agreement.
Senator from Christian, do not interrupt two senators when they're debating. Please follow decorum. Proceed, Senator from Buchanan.
I find it ironic.
Thank you, Senator.
I mean, talk about the irony of the senator from Johnson telling someone in this chamber to follow the decorum.
I tell you, I didn't actually notice the senator from Christian.
He didn't bother me either.
He didn't bother me.
He kind of slid in from the side there, and you couldn't even tell.
No, I just didn't notice.
Yeah.
But that's okay. But the bottom line of it is here is...
Johnson was trying to attack him, so...
It was explained to me that this problem of RECs, not allowing another broadband provider to attach so that their own subsidiary could, that seems pretty nefarious to me, and I think it might be a way to work this out. I'd like to propose to you for your consideration. How about we simply say that during the time that the written agreement is not given, that the REC cannot allow anybody else, any other broadband provider to attach.
Well, Senator, let's use this scenario. That's an interesting idea. I oppose it, and here's why. Let's say that you're the rural electric cooperative.
Kind of not surprised that you're opposing it, but go
ahead.
Well,
I'm trying to understand why you don't want my constituents to get broadband, but that's another discussion for later here. Let's say that you're the rural electric cooperative. And you and the senator from Christian enter into an agreement, and he is deploying his fiber optic network on your poles, and I then come to you as a now would be the third provider on those poles and say, I would like to enter into an agreement, but I'm only willing to pay 20% of what you're charging the senator from Christian. So you and I start negotiating, and at that point we can't get to an agreement. And I say, enough's enough. I want to go to mediation.
Okay, then
under
how about
your scenario, the senator from Christian, who's done nothing wrong, who has a written contract with you to deploy his services, is now halted because I will not come to an agreement.
Okay, well, then how
I
about
now
this?
Have the competitive advantage that now I can stop any of my competitors from deploying networks because all I can do is once the first wire goes up, I can come to you and say, listen, I disagree. I want to put it on there. You say no. I'm like, all right, let's go to court, and bam, just shut everybody down.
What if the senator from
Christian... And once again, you're sitting in St. Joe with great broadband, and my poor mom and dad are watching Channel 2 over the air.
What if the senator from Christian is you? What if the senator from Christian is your right arm, and the senator from Christian is actually negotiating a deal with you that is kind of inflated because of the fact that you get paid on the back end? I mean, now you're the senator from Christian is your subsidiary.
Okay.
And so in order to kind of manipulate this situation, you go, hey, Senator from Christian, I'm going to sign a contract with you, which is maybe five times our cost. And because we know that we're going to get it on the back end, so you're going to pay us, and we're going to pay it back to you through some other channel. Now, all of a sudden, you've locked out the real provider. How about this? How about saying, if you haven't got a written agreement with anyone else, then you can't enter into one until this is worked out. And if it is such that the one that you've worked out the agreement with is a subsidiary of your own, well, then you need to go ahead and let the other provider, onto the pole, and then work out the details later. How about
that? There is absolutely no scenario under God's free earth that we are going to let a provider attach to poles without an agreement, because what you're doing is you are taking all the rights of the property owner away and giving it to someone else while they negotiate.
Well, don't they?
That is the most insane thing I've ever heard, and I don't know anybody in this body that would ever stand here and say that while you and I negotiate the rent for your apartment, that I get to go ahead and move in and start having parties. And by the way, if we don't get to an agreement, too bad. I've tried.
Well, how about let's just like put competition as the highest order of benefit here. I mean, is it true that other states allow the broadband providers to connect to the poles?
I have no idea, Senator.
Well, then why would you say that there's no case under God's green earth? I mean,
because it's not going to happen in this state. That's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, so it's not going to happen in this chamber.
I mean, there is no scenario by which, and I'm aware of any business agreement, that happens. I mean, when is it that whenever you and I are negotiating on a service or a product, that all of a sudden now we take the rights of one person away?
The hospital association, the hospital. When I walk into the door of the hospital, I just automatically get service, whether the hospital agrees or not.
Because of the federal law.
I mean, the hospital kind of has a monopoly over the delivery of medical care in that situation.
Well, we're
in this situation, the REC has a monopoly over the polls. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there are situations where, like, they should make a good faith agreement. In an attempt to come to an agreement. But if they don't, you can't allow the REC to prohibit one provider when another one that's their own subsidiary is taking advantage of the situation.
Senator,
it's the inhibition of competition.
And I do not believe that scenario has occurred.
Okay, well, I was just told in the hallway just about, 10 minutes ago that has occurred and that is the reason.
Well, Senator, if we believed everything we heard in the hallway, we would think really bad things about a lot of people.
And that wasn't the first time.
I got flyers about you last year and all kinds of crazy stuff that I don't believe any of it. People in that hallway lie to us all the time. They are liars. That is what they get paid to do.
Well, right? If it's not true, then why would it be such a problem to make sure that it doesn't happen?
Because what you're wanting to do, Senator, is you're wanting to continue to build barriers to broadband deployment, which hurt my constituents while yours are not impacted.
Why would you say that? I want to actually eliminate the barriers.
Sick and tired of cable companies who never, ever had any intention to serve where my mom and dad live, or if they did, they'd be serving them today.
Wait a second.
Now, all of a sudden, continuing to stop the constituents of myself and the senator from the 16th from getting service. It's so frustrating.
I think that's so amazing. It's almost 18. Like it's like making me want to laugh that you would actually say that, Senator.
That I want my mom and dad to have broadband service?
I mean, like, how could, like, trying to make certain that a broadband provider could attach to a pole in your area so that they could get service out to you and then get paid a reasonable amount before some other provider, which, by the way, is owned by the REC, gets on the lines, which then monopolizes it and ends up in higher costs to your own constituents. Why wouldn't you want to make sure that competition flourishes so that there wouldn't be that? I would want your constituents to have the lowest possible rates.
I'm all for that.
But well, then let's figure out a way to adjust up the language a little bit.
And how do you want to do it?
Well, how about a reasonable...
Three senators on the floor. Senator from 23rd, what purpose is he recognition?
Mr. President, I believe the senator from Buchanan is disrespecting you by not addressing you.
The senator from Buchanan is reminded to keep at least some portion face to the president. Thank you.
Ooh.
Senator, why do you not like the president?
No, I have to tell you, Senator, I have seen the presiding officer come down on a senator, but I've just never seen somebody like a different senator ask the presiding officer to do that. That was kind of a little different twist. I didn't realize that was,
I think normally it's just
that. You know what that means is that if he can do that, then I can do that. So when I see something like that going on, I can stand up and,
Hey, if you're looking to point out members who are not following the rules, I would encourage you to watch the senator from Johnson for the rest of this week. It will be a target-rich environment.
Well,
if there's a way to get to where you're trying, if what you're trying to do is ensure competition, I support that completely, Senator.
I thought you would because that's
absolutely. I'm not willing to let one company hold up the deployment of another company when that company already has an agreement.
Well, I know, but the only thing that I would be concerned there would be if the agreement is with their subsidiary, which is kind of an unfair advantage. Well, thank you for your inquiry, and I'm going to inquire of the senator from Clay.
Thank you.
Thank you, President.
Senator from Buchanan.
Inquire of the senator from Clay.
Senator from Clay, do you yield?
I do yield.
She yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Thank you, Senator. You understand this issue probably better than I do. But
you know, Senator, I'll have to tell you, I no longer sit on the committee that's chaired by the bill handler. And I've actually been going through the floor substitute because it was just dropped. And my main thing is that your district is a little bit similar to mine in that really it doesn't matter how we vote on this issue, that unless all the parties that provide service to our respective areas come to the table and have a complete agreement, then we're in Solomon's position. We're going to have to split the baby, and the real mother's not going to be real happy. In the problem that I see is in all of the taxpayers in our district, I believe, has their taxpayer money has been used through these federal funds, through grants, stimulus funds, some sort of low-interest loan program. All of that comes from every taxpaying member of our district. Okay. That being the case, then they all have skin in the game and they all have money going out there to allow the broadband and these telecom providers, whether they're cable or electric co-ops or whoever, AT&T, you name it, full access to these facilities, but they're subsidized through our taxpayer money. So then you add the next layer on that. Next layer on that, in a part of your district and a part of my district, we have private property owners with easements for all kinds of utility easements that run across their land. I have people who are upset with a particular telecom company because they ran a rocket-fast fiber optic system across their front yard and through their ditch to reach a very popular subdivision that could afford this rocket-fast service. They wanted it, but they couldn't get it even though their lawn was torn up, and they know that it's just right there at the end of their driveway. So I've got those issues, and I will have to say that, although I'm not naming that particular telecom company, that telecom company has done a lot to try to resolve situations like that. Okay, then we've got our people who already have cable, where cable is already built out. So what I'm really searching for in this bill is, we know at the end of the day that it's not going to be the electric co-op or whoever the pole owner is. It's not ultimately going to be them that pays or that receives, and it's not ultimately going to be the cable company as such, you know, this whoever this cable company is, that pays for the additional pole attachment. Ultimately, it's going to be the cable subscribers, the cable customers who are going to have to pay. So the southern part of my district, a large part of them already have cable, telecom, all sorts of different options that are available to them. In the northern part of my district, cable is much less available. The electric co-ops are doing a fantastic job of providing reliable service for electric out there at a reasonable rate. I've also got Kansas City Power and Light, so there's this massive overlay. I mean, if you try to draw a diagram of it, it would probably look like a treasure map. But, Senator, since you're my legislative neighbor, your district bears a lot of the same concerns. Now, in time, I would like to ask the senator from Andrew a couple of questions, including, has everyone agreed, and I'm taking it from the squabble that I'm hearing in the hallway that everybody hasn't agreed. Is there a way to get everyone to agree?
Well, I talked to Chuck Simoneau from the cable cable association.
You talked to the Missouri Cable Television Association.
Yeah, and
director.
He said that he hadn't seen this. He hadn't seen this sub. I know that the date on there is May the 8th, which is 6 days ago, but he said he hadn't seen it, so he really didn't have a chance to respond. This was the first time I've seen it since it was dropped on my desk a few minutes ago.
Senator, you make a good point. I mean, last year, about this time, only a few days later, I was presiding over this body whenever there was another very explosive issue having to do with nuclear energy that came up, pardon the pun, explosive nuclear energy. But, you know, I'm for the implementation of new nuclear energy power sources, but it came up in the 11th hour on the last day. And you make a good point, and it's a fair point, that this Senate substitute does have a date of May 8th on it, and this is the 14th. And I was sitting in my chair when this substitute was dropped. So I am trying to read through it to do my due diligence. But
well, I guess for me, and I want to know whether this is a reasonable concern or not, and as it was explained to me, is that rural electric cooperatives, some of them have subsidiaries that provide broadband service. And so what they do is there's going to be a subdivision built, and so what they do is they go ahead and allow their subsidiary to put the line on, the cable attachment. Well, when you enter into an agreement with a subsidiary for an amount of money, I mean, it's very subject to monkey business. In other words, yeah, we'll go ahead and let you pay us a huge fee for the cable attachment to these poles to that subdivision, but, you know, you can make up the money by we'll pay you more on some other way. I mean, it really does give the company and its subsidiary a way to manipulate this kind of a law. So what the cable companies are concerned about is the potential for the REC to not agree to a reasonable fee and then force it into mediation and then have it end up going to circuit court. And you and I both know that circuit court can take years. I mean, a couple years isn't at all unreasonable. And by that time, you know, they might as well not even have tried to get an agreement. 2 years goes by.
Three senators on the floor. Senator from Andrew, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you, Mr. President. I ask the bill be put back on the informal calendar.
It will be put back on the informal calendar.
We'll stay on that calendar as you recognize the senator from Johnson on House Bill 1174.
Remaining on the informal calendar, third House bills for third reading, Senator from Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that House Bill 1174 be taken up from the informal calendar and be brought up for consideration.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from Johnson. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Last time we had this bill, there was a Senate substitute.
The Senator from Johnson will realize that I am a President of the Senate at this point in time.
I'm very sorry, Mr. President. Decorum and rules are very important to me, so I'm sorry about that.
What's that?
I would like to ask the current Senate substitute be sent back.
It will be sent back.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now have a new Senate substitute, and I would like to send that forward. I move for its adoption. It has been distributed.
Hearing no objection. You're asking for a waiver of the reading?
I am asking for a waiver of the reading, Mr. President.
Thanks. And hearing no objection, the reading will be waived. Have you moved for the adoption?
I believe I have, but I'll move for the option of the new Senate substitute.
All right, Senator, would you like to explain your substitute?
Point 10F. This is an issue that we've talked about on the Senate floor. We passed Senate Bill 677 a few weeks ago. It passed 33-1, which deals with the immediate takeover of the Kansas City School District by the State Board of Education. Unfortunately, that bill went over the House, and about 8 or 10 amendments were added to it, and so it looks like the passage of that right now is somewhat doubtful. We do have House Bill 1174, however, that came over from the House of Representatives. This is Representative Lair's bill, and it basically is almost the identical bill. A few weeks ago, we did have some language which was attached to it, which dealt with the Turner fix. I believe now that with some of the recent court rulings that might not be as imminent as we thought, and so we don't have to do that. And so what I'm doing is bring this bill before the body to talk about the immediate takeover of the Kansas City School District. I think everyone in this body feels the importance of doing that, of providing an option for that. And so that's why I'm bringing up the Senate substitute for the body's consideration. I'd be glad to take any questions, or if not, I renew my motion.
The Senator from Johnson has moved to adopt the Senate substitute number 2. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Cape, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you, Mr. President, to inquire the Senator from Johnson.
Senator Johnson, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
I appreciate your explanation there, but I was shifting gears from hearing about pole attachment issues, previously workers' compensation, and then we switch gears to 1174.
Right.
Is that
House
correct?
Bill 1174. Have you seen the new substitute?
I have not. I assume you dropped it during the debate of the pole attachment issue.
Yeah, it's been out probably 30 minutes or an hour. So.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I wasn't in here when all of the pole attachment issue was going on, so I didn't know this was dropped. If you could, and I do apologize,
sure.
I know you did, just if you could just hit the broad where we were, what you're trying to accomplish here, and what's different about this substitute versus the last one.
If you recall, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about House Bill 1174, and that was at the time going to be the vehicle that we talked about a Turner fix. Okay. With the recent court ruling, the reason to do it so quickly probably isn't there the way it was a few weeks ago.
Okay.
So what I'm
so even though that's a trial court opinion, it's your as chair of the education committee and working in this area, it's your considered opinion that the pressures to address that, even though it's just a trial court opinion by the same trial judge that's already been overruled by the Missouri Supreme Court once. On the issue, it's you're removing that issue from your substitute.
I think that's a good word, the pressure.
Okay.
I think that's probably a good word. So, and I think also going along with that, Senator, is I think all of us in this body realize that we need an immediate fix for what's going on in Kansas City. The unaccreditation is something that we just can't wait.
Okay. And that was the that was the underlying bill. The underlying bill. And I hate to use these terms, but this is how I categorize stuff. This is the bill that the Board of Education wanted relative to not having to wait 3 years before they could take over a school district. Is that the underlying bill?
That is correct. And let's say the State Board of Education, because
the State Senator, Board, not the Kansas City.
Right.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Because they certainly have a different.
The State Board of Education is advocating. So, does this Senate substitute get us all the way back to the underlying House bill, or what are
there are a few changes in there, but for the most part, it is that concept. We have taken into consideration what some of our local senators from the Kansas City area wanted as far as the makeup of who would be on that state-appointed board, the number of public hearings that we would have, so that there is local input on who would be on there. And so Those concepts are definitely included in this sense.
Would it be a fair characterization of the legislation now that instead of having multiple issues that were present in House Bill 1174, this is now a singular issue bill dealing with the timing of the takeover of in this? It would be any school district.
Oh, you're exactly
so I
right.
don't want to pick
right.
on
right.
Kansas City, but it seems to be the one poised to shorten up this 3-year wait period before the state board.
Right.
So that's the only issue that is left remaining in your underlying bill.
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. All right. And I appreciate that. I'll open it up if there's any other inquiries and take a look at this and do appreciate very much your inquiries.
Thank
Senator.
You, Senator.
Thank you.
We're on the motion. Senator from the Ninth, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you, Mr. President, to inquire of the Senator from Johnson.
From where?
To inquire of the Senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you. Senator, you know, I know that this has been a hard subject and a hard thing we've been dealing with all session, and I want to again thank you. I know that, of course, myself and other folks in the community have called you countless times over the past several months to try to work with you on something that agreeable, something that we thought would be good for the folks at home, being the issues we have with the Kansas City School District right now, and the fact that there are 17,000 students in that school district through no fault of their own right now find themselves in an unaccredited district and scores that have been severely lacking the past several years. So, again, I want to thank you for your work. I certainly hope that the body recognizes the importance of this, not only to myself and the 9th, the senator from the 10th, and those 17,000 kids that happen to reside within that district. I do. I hope that this is something that...
Well, Senator, I would disagree with you on one small thing. You said that we've worked hard on this. I don't know if there's been anyone who's worked harder on this issue than you. And from the very first time that the State Board of Education said it looked like they're going to become unaccredited, you have had dozens and dozens and dozens of public meetings, private meetings, and you have worked tirelessly on this issue. And so it means a lot when we had the Senate Bill 677 and it passed 33-1, and to know that you and the senator from the 10th, who are right in the heart of this issue, were supportive, and your handiwork is all throughout this bill. And so I want to thank you very much for all the work you've done. We had a great hearing when the Senate bill went over the House last week. We had about 15 people or individuals testify for it, and ironically, the only group that was opposed to it was the Kansas City Board of Education. And that was very telling.
Specifically.
Exactly. That was very telling.
Right.
Because it showed to me that we had individuals and groups and parents and folks that in the past had said, we don't want a state takeover, but said, now is the time for that.
Right. And I think what it showed was the level of engagement we've had at home. You talked about some of the community meetings and forums that we've had. We had a group of probably 20 to 25 different neighborhood and community organizations that were meeting weekly. I was leaving from Jefferson City to get home, of course, by 6 by the time of the meeting on Thursdays, so that we could begin to talk about some solutions of things that we thought would be most effective, that they would begin brainstorming on some of the issues that may have been present in St. Louis, how we do some of those things better. And so, again, I want to thank you for the work and being so open, you know, to not just myself and the senator from the 10th, but all those folks at home that have been in your office as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your help.
We're on the motion of the Senator from Johnson. Senator from the 8th, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Barr.
Senator from Johnson, you yield.
Yeah, I do.
You yield, Senator. You may proceed.
Mr. President. Senator, how are you doing this afternoon?
Very good. Very good.
I like you down here better than up there.
Just trying to follow the rules. Just trying to make sure that we all follow the rules.
I don't think I broke the rules, but okay.
Well, you need to talk to the Secretary of the Senate, and I think that we can show you a diagram. And yeah.
Oh. Madam Secretary called me out for breaking the rules?
She will stand behind my decision, I think. So.
I will check with her later on.
Okay.
Hey, can you tell me quickly, I don't mean to hold this bill up. I know that this is important to the Kansas City area. Could you tell me briefly, quickly, how the makeup of the new... The was it SBA? The
SAB.
SAB.
State
Appointed Board is going to be drawn up, and how that would affect the district thereabouts?
More than likely be 5 people. It says no less than 5. So I would assume the State Board of Education would appoint 5. At least 3 must come from the Kansas City School District, so they must reside in the Kansas City School District. The other 2 could come elsewhere in the state of Missouri. And they would, Senator from the... Where's Kiki from? The senator from the 9th, when we were coming up with this, it was one of her ideas that the members be somewhat a reflection of the school district as far as geographical content and things like that.
Okay. And so they would come in, take over the school, and then make decisions like, I know, was it Jim Henson out of Independence, when he took over some schools, he fired most of the teachers and had them apply for jobs.
Exactly.
Can they change the structure and go in and change, remove principals and teachers that they feel aren't doing the job?
That would be one of the advantages, that they would be able to start off with new contracts. Contracts would be null and void, and the state-appointed board would have the ability basically to start over. Now, on the other hand, the existing board could stay on in an advisory capacity. That's what's being done in St. Louis with the three-member SAB there. Their board meets, but really they have no power.
In St. Louis, there's a three-member. This is going to be...
That's right. And I almost hate to bring up St. Louis because it's totally under a different set of state statute, and it's a different situation, but that is a little similarity there.
Okay. Well, Senator, I appreciate your work on this. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Senator the Fourth, what purpose do you seek recognition?
To inquire the Senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield?
I do.
You yield, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you, Senator. Since you touched on it, I want to talk about St. Louis a little bit.
Okay.
I was reading the bill, and it says whenever any school district. Obviously, St. Louis is a school district.
It is, but they are under a different statute, so it would not apply to them when we're talking about the changes with this particular unaccreditation statutes.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. That's all I meant.
Thank you.
On the motion, Senator from Johnson, does any other senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the Seventh, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Fire up the senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield?
I do.
Do you yield, Senator? You may proceed.
Okay, I've just got your sub here. If we can walk through this so I know precisely what's in it, if that's all right.
Sure.
Let's see, under 162.081, let's see, you're bracketing out some things. See, whenever any school district in this state fails or refuses in any school year to provide for the minimum school required under the section or is classified under unaccredited for two successive years.
And what we're trying to do here is, as you know, right now they have two complete school years before they have a takeover of the state. And I think you would agree that that's too long. It would be June 30th before of 2014 before that would happen. So what that does, it eliminates that two school year wait. Right there.
Okay, let me just read it because I obviously couldn't read it until. All right, so what we're bracketing it out is for two successive school years by the State Board of Education, its corporate organization shall lapse. The corporate organization of any school district that is classified as unaccredited shall lapse on June 30th of the second full school year of such unaccredited classifications.
So in this case, it would be June 30th of 2014.
Okay.
They became unaccredited January 1st of 2012, 2.5 years. And I think most everyone in this body would agree that's too long.
Okay, after the school year during which the unaccredited classification is initially assigned. The territory theretofore embraced within any district that lapses pursuant to this section or any portion thereof may be attached to any district for school purposes by the State Board of Education, but no school district except a district classified as unaccredited shall lapse where provision is lawfully made for the attendance of the pupils of the district at another district that is classified as provisionally accredited or accredited by the State Board of Education. And then you add, let's see, the State Board of Education. So basically
right.
Says whenever any school district in the state fails or refuses in any school year provide for the minimum school term required under section whatever or is classified unaccredited. You need a word by in there. Is classified unaccredited, the State Board of the State Board of Education shall, okay? Review the governance of the district to establish the conditions under which the existing school board shall continue to govern, determine the date the district shall lapse, and determine an alternative governing structure for the district. Is there anything in here with how they determine the date the district shall lapse? I mean, it was before 2 years, so how's that determined?
This goes into effect when a district does lapse into unaccreditation.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
This goes into effect when a district does lapse into unaccreditation.
So are you saying that as soon as they're unaccredited, then they lapse?
Yes.
Okay, so then why do we need to determine the date the district shall lapse?
Well, because when you find out the day that it lapses, then that's when the clock starts ticking. And so it would be two complete school years. And so as opposed to just 2 years, in this case it's 2.5 years. And then what's even worse is if it's June 30th of 2014, there's already plans being made for the 14-15 school year. So it's almost three entire school years that it would take before there could be a state takeover. And I think we'd all agree. I think you would too, Senator. That's too long.
Yeah, it is. I just think that, you know, we need to look at this. This was a surprise. And so it seems that we need to look at some of the things in it. So first of all, I want to go through it and see what's in here first, because I understand that 677 had some surprises on it that got sent over here. And so until I read it.
677 has a lot of surprises. There's about 8 or 9
I mean that you sent over from here that nobody knew about. For instance, when you required that they keep a union contract, when that's not even required under the present law. That got sent over and nobody knew that on this floor.
I can't speak to that, but the Senate substitute says that contracts are void.
Okay,
so,
we're just going to read
it. It's a good thing, so I would think that you would like that. So.
Well, let's just read it through, because nobody on this floor knew when we sent 677 out of this office that there was language in there that actually said you will sign a union contract. And right now, when DESE takes over a district, they have the freedom. The SAB, for instance, in St. Louis, has the freedom to do whatever they want.
And that's good.
Well, no, actually it's not good, because the SAB in St. Louis has chosen, and we've talked about this in committee, has chosen to sign a contract that it's almost impossible to do business under. For instance, in the contract that the SAB in St. Louis signed, the union, the SAB, the Special Advisory Board, is prohibited from making any actions or any decisions without alerting the union and getting their permission to go ahead. I mean, we've talked about that in committee. For them to have the right under the SAB law not have any, to have all contracts void, including, you know, teachers' contracts and everything void, and then to sign a contract that says, number one, you can't make any decisions or any actions without contacting the union officials first. And to me, that is a disaster as far as how in the world do you take over a district like this that is in need of turnaround, and then you can't even, your hands are tied, you can't even make a decision. So, and that shows in the outcomes, because they're now in their fifth year. And the statutes, just a minute, the statutes, in a number of places make it clear that the expectation is that within 3 years we'll have enough of a change that it will be provisionally accredited again, or there'll be
right,
some.
Right.
I mean, you and I have both seen that language of 3 years, and the SAB is now in their fifth year, and there's not even been one standard changed, and I think both of us will agree what we're trying to do here: make sure that students are learning. And the way we know students are learning is when one of those standards, like, yes, you're proficient in...
It's an academic standard.
In math.
Right, right.
Or English. That's the one I wanted the most, was that they demonstrate that the children can read. So the other thing on that union contract was that there can be no surveillance cameras in hallways and classrooms, everything. And so I would never, as a member of an SAB, sign a contract that says I can't even put something out there for safety, or I can't take any action, or I can't make any decision without, I mean, those are just examples, mm-hmm. and I think I've talked about those in the Education Committee. And so then for 677, for us not to realize that we required that the SAB would sign those contracts, just, I mean, I can't believe we didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know it. I would have never voted yes. I voted yes on it, and it must have been something that got in a sub at the last minute, and I certainly would not have voted yes for it to pass this body, knowing that it was forcing DESE
to sign a union contract and tie their hands from trying to improve things.
That certainly wasn't the intent, and what is in here is that the SAB has the authority to void all contracts. And so that is not a problem that you're talking about that is happening in the St. Louis SAB, and that is the intent of this.
Well, actually, I think what I think it ought to do, because the SAB in St. Louis has shown us that they're not taking the very tools that we're giving them, and they're signing contracts that are keeping them from achieving and keeping kids from achieving, and I think that they need to do exactly what the statutes certainly implied they expected them to do, was to untie all the shackles that could hold them back from achievement. So I think what we need in here, and I wonder if you'd agree with this, that we go back to the wording I think I put on a previous bill that says you can't sign. All contracts are void. Like we talked about Jim Henson, who's the superintendent in Independence, and what he did when he took over part of the Kansas City area, he let everybody's contract go just like he had a right to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he, you know, re-interviewed everybody that was interested. And so what has resulted very quickly from that, and the senator from, just a second, I'll tell you. The 11th. The senator from the 11th knows it very firsthand how successful that has been. What has happened just off the top of my head is I know that they, as I recall, they started out with about 2,000 students in the area that Independence adopted, and now they're up to about 3,000. So basically enrollment has increased 50%, which is pretty...
And it's worked great.
Yeah, it is working great. So
and you remember what he said, how many teachers they rehired that had been in the district?
I don't remember. What?
None.
Really?
At the high school, yeah.
Well, so it looks like we've got a model there that we should be replicating. So would you accept an amendment that would allow, what would require? I hate to require, but we've seen that if we don't require it, then what they do is they allow themselves to be shackled. But good for... Dr. Henson, for doing it the right way, and we're getting very quick positive results from him. That's one thing. I've got an amendment that's being passed out right now.
Is that point 10S?
Yes, it is. Now, this is a bill that went through your committee. It was the senator from Franklin's bill. This would obviously give a lot of options to students that are now in the unaccredited districts. It's the virtual school bill that I think, it passed your committee. I don't remember the exact number, but it easily passed your committee. And I think this would be a help to students, and then I'll go back to where I was. But I would like, while we're talking on this, if the analysts can put together some language that I think I had before on a previous bill that said, All contracts are null and void, and so whoever takes over has the opportunity to do just what Jim Henson did, because we've seen that that works.
It does work, right.
Yeah, would that be okay with you?
Well, I'd have to see the specific language.
Yeah, well, if the analyst will start on that, that would be really good. And then this bill you're familiar with because it came through your committee and passed, and I think most of the committee members didn't have a problem with it. This is the virtual school language that was the senator from Franklin's bill. And so I'm going to ask Mr. President up there in a minute if I can move on this. But let me ask you what you think about that, because this came through your committee, so you know you're familiar with it.
Right. I believe I voted against it, but I would be opposed to putting this on the bill. A virtual charter school, first of all, I don't know what the fiscal note is on that, and the potential fiscal note on that, and I think
but
it really...
there would be a fiscal note.
There's no fiscal note on that?
No, there would not be a fiscal note, because this would come just like the school districts have charters right now. Virtual is a public school, and we have the option of using that now, but the money's
that would be available for each child, just like they are for charters, would be available for virtual.
Mr. President.
Senator from Johnson.
I ask that this bill be laid on the informal calendar.
It will be laid on the informal calendar. Senator from the 23rd. Senator from 23rd.
As a senator from Christian on that same calendar, House Bill 1563.
Senator from Christian.
Mr. President, I move that House Bill 1563 with the Senate Committee substitute pending be called from the informal calendar and taken up for third reading and final passage, and I do have a substitute.
You heard the motion, the senator from Christian. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator, you want to send your Senate substitute forward? Has it been distributed?
It has been.
I thought it. Senator, we need you to move for the adoption of the Senate committee substitute first.
I move for the adoption of the Senate committee substitute.
Now you may send your Senate substitute forward. Has it been distributed?
It has been.
And you're asking for a waiver of the reading?
I am asking for a waiver
of the reading. Hearing no objection, the reading will be waived. And, Senator, you want to move for adoption of the Senate substitute?
I now move for the adoption of the Senate Senate substitute.
Would you like to explain your motion?
I would. Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, this has about, I think, five parcels in it. The first one is to dealing with social workers. And the situation is we have students graduating as social workers in the state of Missouri. Many other states ask for them to have a state credential saying that they graduated to teach in schools or to do social work in schools. Missouri does not ask for that, but many other states do, and they can't work out of state. Right now, they have been, at least some of them, have been taking care of that problem by getting Illinois, working with the school in Illinois, but that's ending. We'd just like to give them what this will allow. It does not license them in any way, shape, or form. It gives them a state credential simply saying that they have graduated a course at a Missouri school, saying that they can do social work in schools. That's the first part of it. Second is the prescription drug part. We have had this. I think Senator from Polk did it. This simply, it deals with the 90-day prescriptions out of state, nothing in state, but if a mail order pharmacy sells drugs out of state, they can do a 90-day prescription, as I understand it. I believe we've dealt with that on the floor and voted on it. It also has a very small collaborative practice part in it, and what this does, assuming, let's say, there's eight doctors in a practice, the way the law reads today, and they have a physician assistant or a nurse working for them, the law states that they have to overlook 10% of that nurse's work. It could be construed that each one, all eight doctors, have to do 10%, which would be 80%. What this allows them to do is choose one doctor in their practice to oversee 10% of that nurse's work. That's what it does. It just says one doctor can be chosen to do that work and overlook 10% of their work. Another part, the senior senator from St. Charles had behavior analysis. What this does when a student graduates to do this, there is a time period before they can get their license, before they can take that license. This would allow them to work under a licensed behavioral analysis up until the time that they can get their license, up until that time when their license comes up where they can take it. That's all it does. It also has a piece in it for employee disqualification list today. The MHA does disqualification list. Their members can go to them. If they're trying to hire someone, they can go to them for, they do background checks on them, and then the hospital or the member would have to, then go to social services to get the EDL. This would allow the HMA, that branch of it that does their background checks, to do both. They could, it's kind of a one-stop shop thing. It just makes it a little easier for them and a little less cumbersome. Those are the things I believe that it does in here. There is an emergency clause at the end of it for the students who graduate this year. Other than that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator from Christian moves adoption of Senate substitute for House Bill 1563. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Cape, what purpose do you seek recognition?
To inquire the senator from Christian.
Senator from Christian, you yield.
Gladly.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you for yielding, Senator, and I appreciate your explanation there. I just want to fold through these. This is the last week. I want to make sure we have an understanding of what's in the bill. I'm not attempting to delay your bill. I know that I think what the floor leader is trying to do, not to read anything into it, is go to these bills that have Senate substitute that needs to be dropped, give us an opportunity to look at them, and then we'll probably adjourn here and go to the governor's barbecue, and then we might be coming back later on afterwards to see where we're at. I don't know what his ultimate plan is, but I need to understand, and I want a better understanding, and I may inquire of the senator from the St. Charles area about this behavior analysis stuff.
He would be better than I, Senator.
Okay.
There's no doubt
about that.
All right,
and I want to make sure it's the language that we've worked on in the past, dealing with all of that. And why don't I just go ahead and do that at this
sure.
point? I apologize for inquiring. Mr. President.
Senator from Cape.
If I could inquire the senior senator from St. Charles.
Senator from Second, do you yield?
Yes, I do, Mr. President.
You yield, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I don't know if you had an opportunity to hear my inquiry with the senator from Christian. It looks like, you know, what vehicles are moving, and everyone tries to get on those vehicles that they think are moving. I noticed that in his legislation we've added language from Senate Bill 803, which relates to behavior analysts. That's with the autism service provider of that spectrum disorder. I know you've been a leader of that. I thought 803 was your bill.
It was. It's the same language.
It's the same language that
we passed
out.
Same language we passed out of here twice, okay. And it's just for that period of time while they're, you know, waiting to take their exam.
Okay,
It doesn't go down the road that you and I were concerned about a couple of years ago. It just allows the department to grant this temporary a license until they sit.
And evidently that particular version of the language has not made it onto the governor's desk in any of the vehicles that we've
sent out. No, we've passed it out of here twice. It's over there somewhere.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator. Mr. President.
Senator from Cape.
Now to inquire the senator from Christian.
Senator from Christian, you yield. He yields, Senator.
Thank you for yielding, and I appreciate that opportunity to get that out of the way. As it relates to this, are most of the things we've already dealt with in here, like I know we've talked at length about the authorizations of the collaborative practice arrangements to specify a different doctor. Is that language we passed out before?
The only thing that I know of, Senator, that has not gone through here, I believe, is that last part, the employee disqualification list. I don't think it has.
And let's start there then. What is the employee disqualification?
That is the HMA has a business within it, I guess the best way I can put it, that
what,
does...
What, HMA?
The hospital, or maybe I'm saying it wrong, the Hospital Association.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they actually have a 383 that writes medical malpractice insurance and insures all of their doctors.
Right.
And then they have another business
that
administers the FRA tax.
Right. This branch does background checks for their members.
Okay.
They've done that for years. The way it is now... The member would have to go to them for the background check. Then the member has to go to the department for the EDL. What this would do is allow the Hospital Association and only the Hospital Association to apply for the EDL from the department and send it back to the member.
So instead of going through two background checks, since you've already done one,
exactly,
and they're ostensibly the same thing, we're just being able to use that background check with
the department. That's exactly what it does.
Fair enough. And then the collaborative practice agreements is the same language that we've worked out on this floor.
Yeah, it's just very simple, where you could misconstrue what we've said or what is in statute by saying that, for instance, the example I gave, if you had eight doctors in a practice, each one would have to do 10% of her time, where you would actually be doing 80%. This allows them to elect one doctor within that firm. It has to be in that group to say that they're going to do the oversee her, I guess, in other words, is what I'm saying.
Or him.
Right.
Yeah, and then we have the prescription drugs.
Right, that was the House bill coming over, and as I understand, I think the senator from Polk has done that bill here on the floor.
Okay.
And it deals with 90-day prescriptions, but only out of state. As I understand it, that's not in Missouri, but other states allow the 90-day prescription, and this would keep them from having to call that doctor on a 30-day period to ask for the renewal when he doesn't understand that his state, you know, he's saying, why are you calling me every 30 days when we have 90 days?
And that's, okay. And then the other one is just the social workers.
Yes, and that simply comes from, I think that kind of came late. They've had a problem where a lot of states outside Missouri, Missouri is not one of them, that says you have to have a state certificate saying that you can teach, or not teach, I'm sorry, but work in a school system for a social worker. And our students can't get jobs out of state if they don't have that. This does not license them in any way, shape, or form. It is just simply a form with the Missouri seal on it saying that, yes, you've graduated a Missouri school and you are qualified to teach or to do social work in a school. That's all it does.
Very good. Thank you for the inquiry, Senator. Thank you.
The motion, Senator from the Christian. Does any other senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Boone, what purpose do you seek recognition?
I have an amendment.
Send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
It's been distributed. I'd request a waiver of the reading.
Hearing no objection, the reading will be waived. Senator, would you like to move for the adoption of the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for its adoption.
You may explain your amendment.
Going on. Thank you, Mr. President. This is the e-prescribed language. This is the same language that the Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 1827 has. This language is passed out of the Financial and Governmental Organizations Committee, the Small Business Insurance and Industry Committee, and the House Health Insurance Committee. This is essentially the agreement that was reached between providers, pharmacy benefit managers, doctors, everyone else involved in this process, in order for the state of Missouri to put together a board of experts to help develop a protocol and a pilot program for electronic prescribing. And basically, all this does is, this is where we're going anyway, is to eliminate the fax machine as the mechanism for transferring prescriptions and have it be a tablet like an iPad in a doctor's office. It also allows for, when you've got a pharmacy benefit manager and there's confusion between the doctor and the patient as to what's covered and what's not, the thing that's the biggest benefit about this is it allows the physician to immediately find out what is covered and what is not. And if there needs to be an override to override that or switch the prescription, it is a much better situation for doctors and for patients, as well as for pharmacy benefit management companies that put this together. We did have some concerns about a new board being formed. It's a 6-year period with a sunset. That's in here. We do have Senate confirmation for the individuals that are put on the board. And what we've got an opportunity to do here, Mr. President, is the federal government has been looking at adopting standards for electronic prescribing like this, and they're dragging their feet, and they're dragging their feet. It's hurting the industry, it's hurting patients, it's hurting doctors. So what we've got an opportunity to do here as the state of Missouri is be at the forefront of that and help develop what those protocols will be with this legislation, and then ultimately hope that that ends up being what the federal standard is. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Boone moves the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 8th was the first one I saw seeking recognition.
Inquire, Senator from Boone.
Senator from Boone, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Senator Wright, we were just having a brief conversation before you actually offered your amendment, and I backed away so you could offer the amendment. I am dead set against expanding boards and commissions, and I'm going to try to fight everywhere I can not to have that happen. I understand that in our brief conversation that this is not happening at the federal level and that we can get down and get the legwork going so that the legal language is there to move forward. My question is how, you said this passed out of a committee. Where did that bill go?
They're on the calendar. This has gotten farther.
Just amendments. Okay. So you're just trying to move it along. Yeah. When was this introduced and why was it? Why didn't we not get it through?
I think it's just a matter of the calendar.
What about the?
Because I got to tell you, Senator, this is an issue that we've been working on now for several years, and finally we've got everyone involved in this process to come together to an agreement, which really is pretty amazing from where we started out a couple of years ago. And so the funny thing is there's really no opposition to this because everyone recognizes there's going to have to be a standard. And I think what everybody finally concluded was it's better to be part of the process and develop the standard and get something you know works than have something foisted on you, for example, by the federal government when you're not involved and you're going to get a standard that you know might not work. And so this is by agreement. I really don't think that there's been any holdup as a result of anything on the calendar because, frankly, I think everybody involved in this process who's worked very diligently on this now for a couple of years would really like to see this be implemented.
So there's no way that a private industry can work on these standards and then, distribute them to us to look at? We're creating...
Well, they can't because we regulate every aspect of prescription writing, and so obviously we're going to have to give somebody the authority to develop a process and protocol if it's going to have implications on prescription writing. That's something that you can't do outside of governmental function because it's so heavily regulated to begin with.
Well, it could be, the standards could be drafted and created and then we could adopt them. We don't have to be part of the organization that creates the standard. We could see a third party or a third group.
But you've got to have the imprimatur of the state. You have to have the approval, basically, that this is what's being developed. And on top of that, there's a pilot program as part of this that needs to be implemented in order to see what protocols are going to work. And that's a big piece of this is basically our structure allowing a pilot program so that we know what's going to work in this process.
Well, I will tell you that I'm not going to stand up and filibuster your amendment, but every board or commission that comes forward, I'm going to look for a way not to have it exist, maybe created under the existing board or commission. I didn't get a chance to look at this until you plopped it on our desk a few minutes ago, and I know there's lots of people with different amendments, and it looks like the bill sponsor is standing up. So I don't know what's going to happen here, but thank you for the opportunity to inquire. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Boone, would you ask for unanimous consent to allow adjustment at the dais to the Senate substitute if the amendment is drafted for the Senate committee substitute?
Yes, I would ask for, Mr. President, I'd ask for unanimous consent for the amendment to be drafted to the Senate substitute.
Hearing no objection, then that adjustment will be made at the dais.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Christian.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to lay the bill over, please.
The bill will be laid on the informal calendar. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you see if there are messages from the House? If there are, would you please have those read?
There are messages from the House. Madam Secretary, please read the messages from the House.
Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives that the House refuses to recede from its position on House Amendment 1, House Amendment 2 to Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 566 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 498 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 467 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 455 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 578 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 628 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, the House refuses to recede from its position on House Committee Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 635 as amended and grants the Senate a conference thereon. Also, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House refuses to concur in Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 1807, 1093, 1107, 1156, 1221, 1261, 1269, 1641, 1668, 1737, 1782, 1868, and 1878 as amended, and request the Senate to recede from its position, and failing to do so, grant the House a conference thereon. Respectfully, Daniel Adam Crumless, Chief Clerk.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you see if there are conferees to read, and if so, would you please have those read?
There is. Madam Secretary, would you please read in the conferees?
Conference Committee Appointments on House Committee Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 498 as amended. Senators Munsinger, Crowell, Brown, Callahan, and McKenna. Conferees on House Committee Substitute for Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 467 as amended. Senators Munsinger, Crowell, Lamping, Callahan, and Justice. Conferees on House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 455 as amended, Senators Pierce, Brown, Dixon, Wright, Jones, and Keveney. Conferees on House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 578 as amended, Senators Parson, Munsinger, Engler, Wright, Jones, and Chappelle Nadal. Conferees on House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 628 as amended, Senators Schaefer, Kehoe, Dixon, Justice, and Keveney. Conferees on House Committee Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 635 as amended, Senators Pierce, Engler, Wass, and Justice, and Wright, Jones.
Madam Secretary, would you please refer House Committee Substitute for House Bills 1278 and 1152 with Senate Committee Substitute, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1637 with Senate Committee Substitute, House Bill 1909, House Committee Substitutes for House Bill 1329, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1647, and House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1680, and House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1254, with Senate Committee Substitute to the Committee on Ways and Means and Fiscal Oversight. Thank you. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, Senator, the order of business of reports of standing committees.
Senate shall be on the order of business of reports of standing committees. Senator from St. Francis. Send it on down, Senator, and thank you for the report. Madam Secretary, when it arrives, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Financial and Governmental Organizations and Elections, to which was referred House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1442, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Also, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1869 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass with Senate Committee Amendment 1. Respectfully, Senator Engler, Chairman.
Senator from Andrew.
President, your Committee on Commerce, Consumer Protection, Energy, and the Environment has a report.
Please send that report forward. Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Commerce, Consumer Protection, Energy, and the Environment, to which was referred House Bill 1251, begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the Senate Committee substitute here to attach do pass. Respectfully, Senator Lager, Chairman.
Senator from the 7th.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee on General Laws has a report.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Secretary, would you please read the report?
Mr. President, your Committee on General Laws, to which was referred House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1526, begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Also, House Committee Substitute Number 2 for House Bill 1475 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Also, House Bill 1534 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Respectfully, Senator Cunningham, Chairman.
Senator from Johnson.
Mr. President, your hardworking Education Committee has a report.
Please send it forward, Senator. Madam Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Education, to which was referred House Bill 1062, begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Respectfully, Senator Pierce, Chairman.
Senator from the 15th.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee on Jobs, Economic Development, and Local Government has a report.
Senator, please send that report forward. Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Jobs, Economic Development, and Local Government, to which was referred House Bill 1315, begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Also, House Bill 1096 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the bill do pass. Respectfully, Senator Schmidt, Chairman.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of announcements. I ask you to recognize me for an announcement.
Senate is on the order of business of announcements. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm going to make a recess motion until 7:30 p.m. I know the governor's got his barbecue, and we'll come back and we'll work for an hour and a half or so when we get back. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senate is on the order of business of announcements. Seeing no further announcements, Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming before the body. I move the Senate stand in recess until 7:30 p.m. this day.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from the 23rd that the Senate shall be in recess until 7:30 p.m. this evening. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate shall stand in recess until 7:30 p.m. this evening.